Everyone, and welcome to this special school board meeting this morning. It is Thursday, November the 7th. Would you please stand and join me for the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Once again, good morning, and thank you for those who are in the audience and also for those who are listening via the internet. I'd like to begin the meeting, as I do each and every meeting, by introducing the people around me. So starting on my far left from District 3, School Board Member Linda Cuthbert. Next to Ms. Cuthbert from District 5, School Board Member Mr. Ruben Colon. On the far right to the left there is our agency clerk, Ms. Connie Spire. Next to Ms. Spire, the school board member representing District 1, Ms. Jamie Haynes. Next to Ms. Haynes is our vice chair and representing District 2, Ms. Ida Wright. Next to Ms. Wright is our chief financial officer, Ms. Deborah Muller. And next to Ms. Muller, you got me. And I'm the chair and representing District 4, Carl Persis. So, once again, welcome everyone. Today, what we're going to be doing is interviewing three finalists for the superintendent position. And just a little overview about that for board members. So we're on a strict timeline here for this. And Ms. Messina has drilled it into my head that we must stick to our time frames. So my understanding is that each of you will have about 12 minutes for your part. That includes myself. So we each have about 12 minutes, and then there'll be a time for closing comments from the candidates, and then we. We'll have, after the first candidate, we have a lunch break, and then we'll come back after that to have the second candidate, and then we'll have a 15-minute break only before we start the final candidate. So just to give you some idea of how this process is going to work. So I think at this time, unless board members, do you have any questions about the process itself? Then seeing none, then I think at this time we'll bring in our first candidate.
Board members, this is Dr. Scott Fritz.
Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Fritz. And I also want to let Dr. Fritz know that, in the audience here we have our general counsel, Mr. Stacy Manning. Taking a seat, about to sit down in the back, our chief operations officer and head of just about everything around here, dealing with safety and security and a lot of other things. Greg Akins is his name. And our representative president of our Teachers Association, Ms. Elizabeth Albert, is here. And so just wanted you to know that those folks are behind you. They're good people, all good people. All right. So let's begin. And once again, welcome. Hope you had a good night at the Hilton. Did you
wonderful.
Get to stay there?
Yeah, absolutely.
You
wonderful.
Did?
Absolutely beautiful.
Did you see the sunrise this morning?
Sure did.
It's amazing, isn't
on my
it?
Treadmill.
It was great. Good for you. Good for you. All right. I have a few just opening questions for you, and then we'll start going around
sure.
around the dais. So what is the what in your opinion? What is the most important part of the superintendent's job, and why do you think so?
To start off with, I really do believe that establishing a system of communication is absolutely the most important thing that a superintendent can do, and that communication goes all the way from the top down to the delivery chain to those end. And folks in the classrooms and the staff that's here, that delivery chain has to be pure. And that's why one of the things that I believe is that one message. Truly, there has to be a system of communicating so that our people understand the direction and the vision for the school district.
And why do you think that is so critical?
When silos are created, we lose sight of the focus, we lose sight of the goals, and I think it's extremely important in an organization to make sure that your strategic plan is your way of work. And when those silos are existing, people start going off in different directions. And so one of the things as a superintendent, I think my job is to eliminate those silos, to make sure that that communication is very clear, everybody's very focused on the work, to make sure that our strategic plan really is driving us each and every day.
Thank you. As we select our new superintendent, what are the top three strengths and attributes you believe you would bring to our district and how our district could benefit from those?
As a leader, I believe you're only leading when others are following. And I've had 28 years to build to this point that what I am, where I am today, to sit in front of you to interview for this position. I've not missed a level. I've gone from paraprofessional to sitting here today as the number two in Osceola County, ready to take this step. And as a leader, I can say that I've worked with people to make that happen. So my collaborative efforts have been number one. I have not done anything on my own. It has been with a team. And you're only leading if you're looking behind you and people are following. So for me, collaboration is number one. Number two, I'm a systemic thinker. Remember I talked about those silos. You have to be able to run an organization where you truly have that one message, that you're reaching all of our people. And number three, I'm going to tell you straight up, I've never forgotten the why we do this job. And every employee we have deserves to live their why. My why actually has names. My whys are Amanda, John, Luke, and Michael. And those were four of my students. I had many, but those are four of my students that I met my very first time working in education as a paraprofessional. So I think that drives me each and every day. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think of those four. And that's why I believe that that is one of the strengths that the superintendent needs. Every day you have to know why you do your job. And children have to be part of the equation, because when we take them out, we're not making the right decisions.
Thank you. And now we will begin with our school board members asking questions, and we will begin with Ms. Cuthbert, and we have 20 minutes.
I'm going to go over. I have about five questions, so two or three minutes per one to keep us straight on time.
Sure.
So thank you, sir. As the leader of a large district, how would you influence or create a culture of inclusion that fosters high expectations to close the achievement gap among all our subgroups, such as students with disabilities, students of low socioeconomic status, and students of all racial groups?
Inclusion goes to culture. It speaks about the culture that we have created in our schools. I think one of the things that we have to do for all of our schools is have stability and leadership. I'm a big believer that leadership matters. And so when we say all means all, it really has to mean all. All students have opportunities to be successful. They may need different scaffolds. I love the illustration where children are looking at the fence and looking over at the baseball game. And then you have three little kids. One standing on two boxes, one standing on one box, and the other is looking over the fence. Our job as educators is to provide the boxes so that all of our students can excel. And that truly does mean all. Our most challenging students at our ESC, and that was where I got my background as a paraprofessional and then a teacher, I've seen amazing accomplishments with our ESC students. And as a school district, part of our job needs to be to take those students that are graduating in the areas of VSE and making sure that they are valued members of society. They have to be able to go to work for us. And as a school district, I would challenge us to make sure that we're making that happen and showing our partners in the community that not only do we educate our students with the have VSE, but we also employ them. So in Osceola County, one of the things I'd love to mention is that we have a program where we are taking 10 students a year and training them in our warehouse, our food service, and our custodial. And at the end of their successful internship, when they age out at 22, we hire them.
So, thank you. Yes. Thanks very much. What innovative ideas do you just might happen to have for Volusia County schools to address the graduation rates across all subpopulations?
So I got to tell you, that's the low-hanging fruit. We have two. It's graduation and acceleration in the high schools. No one would ever throw away $100,000. And when we think about educating students from K to 12th grade, that's approximately the expenditure that we have to spend, taxpayers have to pay. So every time a student doesn't cross that stage, that's money being wasted. We have to change the conversation. In Volusia County Schools, we have to change the conversation. When they enter ninth grade, it's not about getting the proper credits that they have to walk across that stage. It's about what do you want from the four-year experience while you're in high school. They need a hook. They need a hook. They need a pathway. I do believe in acceleration for all. I think that our target should be within 3 years that our graduation rates are at 90%. In Osceola County Schools, over the last 10 years, we've taken them from 62% to 89.3%. Some of the ways that we've been able to do that is we provide that hook and those pathways for students, but we also understand that there are other assessments that are gatekeepers for students in high school. That algebra exam and the 10th grade FSA sometimes. Students have experienced these type of assessments for years, and it serves as a roadblock for them. So we've been very proactive in giving the PSAT and SAT and ACT to our students because sometimes unlocking them, unlocking their talents, comes from a different type of assessment. And when you sit down with a student and tell them that they are going to take a college readiness exam, their eyes light up. Their eyes light up because someone believes in them. We also have to look at credit recovery programs for our students. We have to make sure that just because a student earned an F in a class, we're not saying they didn't learn anything. Some of the credit recovery programs take into account the mastery levels where students have learned information in their courses. Some of the credit recovery programs are very proactive because they provide a coach. A teacher is more of a coach for them to help guide these students. We call them student success plans. If you need 9 credits to graduate, we'll put you on a timeline to help the student, telling them that you have to get the next course in the next 4 weeks in a credit recovery program. That type of success makes it meaningful to them. And I do want to stress the fact that every student needs to have a pathway. And remember I talked about those ESC students, their pathway may be going to work. College is not for every student. But what we need to make sure is there is absolutely a pathway starting in grade 9 for every single child that comes into our school. One of the things that we are doing in Osceola is we're making sure that our guidance counselors get some of their time back. We have worked with our high school principals so that every child gets 2 touches a year with a guidance counselor. Now, that's why the guidance counselors went into that business. I think that's something that we should be committed to. That means we may have to look at some of the things we're asking them to do. But there have to be at least 8 times in a high school career that a guidance counselor is sitting down with a student asking what direction they want to go. How are they doing? How do we help them cross the stage and make sure that high school is about preparing them for the next step?
Okay, to tag on that, I do know bringing a concern of teachers and on the campus. How would you assist teachers and school principals in handling the too many distractions that now face our classrooms? Special assemblies, fairs, drills, because we just don't have fire drills, now we have lockdown practice. Concerts, pull-out meetings, special events, guest speakers. Then any school day brings to the classroom while preserving the supporting the precious academic time for not only teachers to carry out their planning, but also for students to continue their lifelong learning.
So I think a lot of this goes back to that one system that I talked about. I truly believe that one of my first tasks will be to establish focus groups with my principals. I would want to do that with elementary, middle, and high. And I say that word, my principles, because I want you to understand that as the superintendent, there will be a bond between me and the principals in this school district. We will work together. I need them to hear things directly from me, and they need to hear. I need to hear things directly from them. So one of the things that we will look at doing is making sure that there's such a communication that we're understanding what things we have to do. I mean, the law is very clear. Those drills have to be done. We don't have an option not to. So those are things that have to be done. We have to look at things that are optional. I certainly don't want to take enrichment opportunities away from students. But I also want to make sure that we're valuing teachers' time and that we give them what they need. The partnership between myself and Elizabeth and her team is going to be critical. Those meetings that she and I will have will be regular. And really, the more she and I can put out there one message together, the stronger this school district's going to be. I do believe that that's very doable. I think that the union and myself have very similar goals. We want to make sure that teachers have time to do their jobs to educate our students. We all want them to nurture their why. And so a big way that I think on doing that, Ms. Cuthbert, is to make sure that we're having those regular communications and that I truly understand what the needs of this district are. Once I hear them in those listening tours, I think that I shared a little bit in my writings about what those listening tours would look like. I'm going to go in and ask those four questions. What does success look like in Volusia County Schools? What initiatives are helping our students be successful? What traditions or initiatives should we just discontinue? And what's your greatest concern in Volusia County Schools?
Thank you very much. My last question. I'm glad to get 4 out of 5. What is your vision for student learning, especially online learning, STEM as well as CTE?
So I'll say right off the way off the, from the beginning that I want to see us expand CTE offerings. One of the things that I want to do is start a committee, and it kind of mirrors something that we're doing in Osceola County. I want to have a superintendent's skill trade committee so that I can hear from our industry leaders what type of workforce they need. And then we can start backwards planning that in our high schools and working with our partners like Daytona State, because I think that's really going to be critical in providing that direction. Online learning, I think, you know, that really is the way of the future. I would like us to expand our services. While Florida Virtual and there are other options out there are wonderful, I think the benefit of having our own Volusia virtual school is our teachers are right here. And it provides parents an opportunity that if they need to have a conference, they can. It also provides students the opportunity to do brick and mortar as well as online opportunities. So I'd like to see what we can do about making sure that's a very rich experience. And I will say this. One of the challenges that I've given the Osceola Virtual Program is to bring in some of those brick and mortar activities. For example, honor roll celebrations. Students going to Volusia Online should also be able to have honor roll celebrations. They should also be able to have student government. And so those are some of the activities that we're doing to expand our program. We have expanded in Osceola. We've added 11 full-time teachers there from only part-time teachers in the last 2 years.
What about STEM?
STEM, I think, is very much connected to CTE. When I say CTE, I want everybody to understand that engineering is CTE. And biomedical is CTE. We have really taken that in Osceola County to an extreme level. We have Project Lead the Way in every elementary, middle, and high school. We have pathways in every school. We've opened 7 NAF academies in the last 4 years. We've provided transportation to our technical college so that high school students can be a part of that. But we've also extended those areas that will require formalized college education that are STEM related. For example, nursing. We have a high school that we opened last year, and it's called Neo City Academy. That's a partnership with UCF. It's a partnership with the county government, and it's a partnership with Bridge, which is an engineering firm in our county. This partnership allows students to go down a track of biomedical science, cybersecurity, and engineering. And when those students become juniors and seniors, they'll receive dual enrollment courses from UCF.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your input.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. And now we'll move on to our next school board member, Mr. Ruben Colon. Mr. Colon.
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
So I'll be covering internal and external communication. How would you ensure that the school board is kept informed on important matters?
You guys are my bosses, so you will be informed. I think one of the most important things we can do, because I really do know that the research says, and I believe this in my heart, that the tighter team we are, the more trust there is between you and I, the more successful our school district is going to be. So I will tell you that if I am appointed, November 13th, I will reach out to you, and we will start setting up regular meetings that works for you. I want to make sure that you are teaching me about our school district, that I am learning from you, from what constituents have said to you we need to do in this school district. So regular meetings are a big part of that. The listening tours that I mentioned, I think those will be a big piece because I will be able to bring back information to us if we decide to revise or completely reconstruct our strategic plan. That one message that I talked about will be critical to everybody in this room because our leaders at the schools, our teachers, our principals, they need to get one solid direction. So one of the first things I'm going to do is make sure that those supervising principals and those that are supporting curriculum instruction are in the same house and that they're delivering the same message. As board members, I will give you the date for the December 10th school board meeting that we'll have. By December 2nd, you'll have all presentations in your hand to review because I want you to have time to reflect. I want you to have time to ask questions of staff and myself if there's something you're unclear of. I think that's critical. There will be no surprises. I want to make sure that we're valuing your time. And one thing I've learned is, as the number two in a school district, working with board members, and even serving as the designee when the superintendent's been called away at those board meetings, is you need time to make those decisions. So staff will be instructed to make sure that all those PowerPoints, presentations are previewed in cabinet meeting with me, and then that we get you the information 8 days ahead of time. The other thing that I'm going to do is make sure that we have a very clear hiring process for school leaders. I do believe in community stakeholder input, and while names may surface, I'm more concerned about attributes of what a school really needs. But we're going to set up a hiring procedure where a committee will interview the applicants, whether for an assistant principal position or an area superintendent can run it if it's a principal position. Then cabinet will interview those top three that are sent to us. Once we interview, and when I say cabinet, I want HR in the room, I want finance in the room, and I want teaching and learning in the room, and all other folks that would be necessary to make that type of a decision or judgment. Then on that Friday or Monday before the board meeting, I will call you, each one of you, personally, and tell you what the recommendation would be so that you're not surprised at the dais who I'm recommending because you've been in the community a long time, and I want to know your input. Regarding emergencies, I think this is critical. You have got to have information when asked by constituents or the media. If there's not a procedure right now, we'll have one. When something happens in a school, cabinet will set up a command text. That'll come from the chief operating officer and his team. When something happens, we'll have a command text letting us know. If it's newsworthy, as soon as we have the information, you will have the information. The big thing about communication is this. To have a good offense is your best defense. And I truly believe that the more proactive we can be, the more communication we have, the stronger our school district will be.
Great. Thank you. When a new superintendent is hired, you want to make sure that the transition is as smooth as possible for everyone. How would you help both the educational community and the community at large adjust to the new governing style that will come with a new superintendent?
Lots and lots and lots of talking and meetings and listening. those listening tours will be vital. I really do believe that they're going to be important, and I'm going to need to hear from board members of which groups and which communities you feel that I need to go to and hear, because you know this is your community and you understand that. Again, those focus groups, it's not just principals I want to meet with. I want to meet with the teachers. I want to meet with staff. I want to meet with families. I think having regular conversations with the union will help that as well, to understand those pulse points. Because I do believe this is a board, we're coming to the end of our strategic plan. We have to make some decisions. Do we revise the strategic plan? Do we just do away with it and get more stakeholder input to recreate a plan? But those can only come from us listening to the folks in the community. And so a part of that adjustment, being the new superintendent, will be very, very, I have to be very, very visible. I have to be out there. And so getting your guidance and guidance of folks that have been serving in the community as well as in the school district itself will be critical.
Great, thank you. How would you ensure that staff is informed on all important matters?
That one message. Cabinet meetings, the way I intend to run cabinet meetings is they'll be every Monday. We will start our day with my cabinet here, and we'll review board agenda items. There will be a process, for example, to go through to get things done. Position reviews, for example, will come to cabinet. When there's vacancies that occur in various houses, I need staff to bring those to cabinet so that we can have everybody in the room when we're making a decision. Do we refill this position, or should it be repurposed? When it comes to new project requests, I need them to bring it to cabinet. In fact, we're going to input a three-step process so that we can detail the scope of work, we can look at the fiscal impact, and we can also make sure that this project is worth doing. And so you need the people in various departments to have a hand in that. That's the check and balance of the system. That eliminates those silos. So cabinet meetings are going to be very, very important. And the expectation I'm going to have from my cabinet is everything that pertains to them and to this district, that they're holding their own meetings and making sure staff is informed. Teaching and learning, the area superintendents, the CAO, will be one division. They'll be expected to be at my cabinet meeting because our core business, our why, is teaching and learning. Even though there are many divisions and many departments in the school system, everything exists to support the teaching and learning that supports our teachers and students and principals. So those meetings will be very important.
Great, thank you. What methods of communicating with parents have you found most effective, and how would you encourage and leverage the parental involvement in our district?
I will tell you, parents, communicating with parents is critical because they have choice. They don't have to choose us. So the more connected they are to our schools, the more they will choose us. I think social media is great when it helps us communicate. I think we can also over-communicate. I think we have to be very strategic in what we share as far as how often we share. Lots and lots of parent opportunities for us exist. We run a SAC cadre with our SAC teams every month in Osceola County. So the SAC teams come and they hear from various divisions in the organization, including the superintendent and myself, on a regular basis about what we're doing. I think it's very important for our strategic plan to be able to be easy for parents to be able to read and understand. I think that's something that we've done extremely well in Osceola County. You can pick up our strategic plan, and you can certainly make sure that everybody in our community can read it. And they can read it in English, and they can read it in Spanish. And so I think it's really important for us to make sure that we do that. Now, regarding family involvement, that is not really a one-person, one-department initiative. It takes everybody. It truly takes the village to raise students and children. To be able to do that, we need to be able to reach out. One of the things that Osceola County did is we made community involvement, we called it governance, but it was one of our goals, and that was in the first three-year rendition of our strategic plan. And I will tell you, we did that on purpose, and we started with the cabinet, and we made sure that as we started to get family involvement, that everybody on cabinet joined professional organizations and community groups to be able to support that. We've since rolled that down to our principals and our assistant principals. Sometimes principals need permission to do those type of events. For example, Rotary Clubs. We have given our principals permission to be a part of that. We've given them permission to be a part of the Boys and Girls Club. We've given them permission to be able to go out and meet the needs of their schools. But they have to be given those opportunities to do that. And again, that's not something that one department can do. So I think that that's a big piece of it. Remember when I talked about the superintendent taking on certain things like the superintendent skilled trade committee? I think working with our community partners, for example, one of the nonprofits that I've researched is the faith group, the Fight Against Injustice Through Harmony here in Volusia County. As a superintendent, I see opportunities, and maybe things have already been done, but some of the things that I see is I'd like to work with those leaders to help our students use their voices rather than their fist. And I think that's a great group to mentor and help. So there are opportunities, there are things that the superintendent will have to take on personally, but I want to make sure that our leaders understand that what that looks like, and I want my cabinet to set the example.
Great, and I'm going to sneak one last one in. How do you plan to communicate with the public on matters of school concern? You've spoken a lot about the folks who are in the district, the parents, et cetera, but how about the general public, our constituents who may not have children in school?
When you say matters of concern, are you talking about emergencies or just about our school in general?
Just about our school district in a positive way.
I do believe there are different groups that I need to be in front of. The economic affiliates such as chambers and rotaries I certainly need to be a part of. I need to make sure that my cabinet is as well. I think I'll get a lot of that information from board members because you'll know the pulse points of places I need to go and meet with. I think the academic affiliations with the universities in the area will be critical for me to make sure that I'm communicating with them on a regular basis. I think that's grounds for great opportunity for us. And again, those 501Cs and those nonprofits that are out there in the community, from you as board members, I need to know which ones to be a part of.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Colon. And we're moving on. Next questions will be from school board member, Ms. Jamie Haynes.
Thanks.
In our system, the superintendent handles the operations of a variety of programs and duties due to the size of the system. Explain your specific experiences with exceptional student education, federal programs, and career tech.
Exceptional student education, I was an ESE teacher. And as a cabinet leader for the last 11 years, exceptional student education has come under my watch. And I'm a very proud father of a 25-year-old daughter that's intellectually disabled, who is employed and thrilled at everything she accomplishes. And right now she's at work as we speak. My involvement with ESE has been extensive, and it's personal. It's one that I want to make sure that all of our students are being productive. The statistics are against them. 82% of students that graduate from self-contained ESE programs across the nation are unemployed. They have higher rates of depression. And so as the lead of an organization, I want to make sure that we're doing everything in our power to turn those odds. I think that's why I mentioned earlier that we have to own part of that. There's always a need for employees in the school district. We have to be willing to hire them. And as a superintendent, that'll be a huge initiative for me. The other thing you mentioned was CTE. CTE, again, it was wrongly said, but it was said that, well, if you don't go to college, maybe you can be a plumber. Okay. My best friend is an electrician, and his toys are a lot nicer than mine. I can share with you that those are noble professions. And we need to encourage that. In school systems around the country, we hurt for HVAC employees. We hurt for electricians. We need to create those right here. We have the workforce. We have 63,000 students. That's about changing the conversation. And you have to have the conversation early. And it's okay if a kid says, I want to be a diesel mechanic. In Osceola County, over the last 4 years, we have opened electrical, plumbing, manufacturing, welding is on the way. Very excited about that opportunity, and we've added 7 NAF academies in our high schools.
So the other area was Title I or federal programs.
Title I and federal programs has also been under my purview. We have had exceptional audits. I'm very pleased with that. But when I look at Title I funding, and I'm going to share how that's done, our whole budgeting process in Osceola County, there is an opportunity for principals to sit down with me and our team. That's all of teaching and learning, human resources, finance, and operations. And every year they sit down with us and we go through each school's needs and how they're going to spend those dollars. And there's specific emphasis on Title I, because that Title I service should be something different. It should be something on top of what the school district is already responsible for doing. So we engage in conversation with each principal about how they will spend their Title I dollars. And there, it's so some districts, I'll be honest with you, they just let principals take care of it. And the way I envision this working here in Volusia County is same way. I will model it for the first year, because I want them to see how it's done. But we will sit down with all divisions and school principals to make sure that we are getting their needs met, and there has to be conversation around those federal programs and how we spend those dollars, because as you know, the feds are getting tighter and tighter and more critical about how we use them.
So to piggyback on your response there, my next question is, to what degree do you believe responsibilities can and should be delegated to principals? How would you hold them accountable for accomplishing those responsibilities?
The building leader is responsible for everything that happens on that campus, as the superintendent is responsible for everything that happens in their school district. How I would hold them accountable. Bar none, their most important responsibility will be the students and staff that they have. And I will say this. While we all want our leaders to be successful, sometimes we have to ask ourselves very difficult questions. And when it comes to hiring people, when I hire an assistant principal, I'm not hiring an assistant principal. I'm hiring a future principal. And so if I have clogs in the pipeline, if I have folks that are blocking our progress, tough decisions may have to be made. And that's okay. Because the reality is the instructional leader at the school, the principal and the assistant principals, are the second most impactful variable for student achievement, the first being the teacher. And so if I have something not working, we'll take care of it.
From a district perspective, explain how student performance standards impact planning and prioritizing of facilities, fiscal, technological, and human resource projects.
So I'll go back to something I said earlier. When we take students out of the equation, we're not asking the right questions. So students have to be the center. That's why I like the allocation process that I described to you, that when we get into a room, we have all departments there working with the principals about the next their next year's needs. I will share with you, that's not a one and done. I typically meet with my principals in March. We go through that allocation process, because here's something important to remember. That allocation process around their needs drives not only the academic day that they're going to have, but also our human resources, because of what teachers we're going to have in the school. The allocation process drives that. So I don't want to wait until April. I want our schools by the end of February to have their allocation so that they can start planning. Having that meeting with myself and staff this first year will be critical. Now, I will share with you, once I feel that staff has that, probably year two I'll turn that over to my lead for teaching and learning, but year one I want them to see that. And I want to make sure that HR is in the room, because as a principal talks about vacancies in March, I want to make sure that we're jumping on it. Regarding vacancies, I'll just say to you that that's a 365-day-a-year job. I mean, we have no longer the opportunity to have a hiring season in our business. And one of the things that I would do with our HR staff, just so you understand how it comes back to students, is I would ask them to establish their quotas, that we would actually try to make a quota system. So if we have 300 vacancies in Volusia County schools every year, then I would want them to start working on that. There are certain things that we can do to make that happen.
How would you characterize your relationships with employee groups in the current position, in your current position? And how would the unions in your current and previous districts describe them?
Well, I could tell you my secret to success working with talented people has been to my relationships with them. There is no doubt about it. I'm sure that there are a few of my friends and family watching this interview today, rooting me on. So relationships are a key piece of what I do. I can tell you that my relationships with the unions have been strong. Two of my references, one being the president for Osceola County. The other, another reference, it's not a letter, but it's on there, is a teacher that had moved with me when I was principal at Benito Middle School to Open Junta, and he was our CTA rep. It's about getting down to the root of it. It's about why we do what we do, getting back to our why. That should be the purpose for every conversation that we have in this business. And so I will tell you that's never been an area I've struggled with, and I wouldn't think it would be an area I'd struggle with as your superintendent.
The final question I have, and this is on everyone's mind, how would you address the issues of safety and security?
Sad that we have to address this, but we do. First thing that I will think about it was this morning when I got up, and the last thing I'll think about when I go back to sleep tonight. There are some things that out there that we have to do because of compliance. And so certainly you mentioned the drills. They have to be done. But there are some proactive things that I think will be our best defense as well. I would want to meet with law enforcement. Sheriff Chitwood and I need to probably get together and do some public service announcements about what is acceptable behavior so that our students see it coming from me and from him. I think those public service announcements should be something that we refresh every year. I think that we have to address the mental health issue in our schools. I'm going to tell you, in Osceola County, we've added over 40 guidance counselors in the last 4 years and have done that intentionally. And if money was endless, I would add more and more. Because I think guidance counselors need to get back to the root of their job, which is working with children. I think social-emotional learning, that's the one thing of the law, that while some districts have said, golly, that's one more thing we got to do. Yes, that's one more thing we have to do. We have to make sure our children are healthy. We have to make sure that they're getting their emotional needs met. That means they have to have contact with caring adults each and every day. So I think that was actually a good decision from the legislation to make sure that that happens. Again, those compliance areas, I do think that we have to make sure those get done. This school district cannot afford not to be compliant. We have to do that. We have to make sure that the training is there for our folks. Again, it may not be convenient, but you know what? We want to avoid tragedy at all cost, and so therefore we have to make sure that we have a very proactive team. My safety and security director will live, breathe, and sleep safety and security. I expect updates daily. I expect them to be the point contact person when there's a problem in our school. I expect that command text to go out to cabinet within seconds after they receive the information, and I expect public relations to be ready for a communication to you when something comes out.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes, and we are moving on to our next school board member, Vice Chair, Ms. Ida Wright.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What is the largest budget that you have been responsible for or had to oversee, and what was the greatest opportunities, and challenges in that budget?
Well, Osceola has a district of 1.2, but I can't tell you I'm solely responsible for that. I am responsible for a large chunk of that because of under teaching and learning, we have many, many dollars. For example, our Title I dollars were over $24 million. Our Title III dollars were about $18 million. When I was in Orange County Public Schools, our district staff there, because it was such a large district, I was probably responsible for about $250 million worth of budget. But one of the things that I'm responsible for is our strategic plan. And I am the overseer of the strategic plan as the number two. That includes monitoring that to make sure that it's being done correctly. And one of our goals in Osceola County is fiscal responsibility. So I've had to put in procedures to make sure that we're not leaving any dollars on the table. And so we've done several things to do that. If you'd like me, I could elaborate on that. It's okay. So one of the things that we've done is we've taken teaching and learning, and we've taken operations, and we put them together in a group called LIST. And we meet every 3 weeks, and we developed a data management calendar. Anything that's worth a point or worth a dollar goes on that data management calendar. Anything that's a survey, like a survey 2 or 3, goes on that calendar. We make sure that we do pre-survey, pre-FTE checks with all of our schools, where our teams come down 2 weeks prior to FTE to make sure that we are getting every possible point and every possible dollar. In 4 years, we've not lost a dollar. We've had a zero null FTE. Part of that process of LIST going through and looking at that data management calendar is seeing what's coming up in the next month. So it's being proactive to make sure that if there are any kind types of problems, we're addressing them. That just happened. I mean, we realized that one of our charters left off Survey 5 data for acceleration, and we were able to catch it in enough time to fix that. So being proactive in that sense, and those are dollars that we're talking about leaving on the table. The new project request and the school opening, that's another area that I'm over. Every time we open a new building, I bring together the facilities department, the IS department, HR, and we come in and we look at how to make sure we stay on timeline and within budget. There's a budget set for new projects. We cannot go over that. Sometimes it's necessary for a change order to happen, but we establish the procedure that our chief facility officer meets with the board members to let them know what that change is. But that's part of the process to make sure we're saving those dollars.
Thank you. Our funding budget concerns are paramount to the continued success of this district. Please describe the process you have used when budget cuts have been necessary, and please expand on your position related to budget reserve dollars.
We don't know exactly what's coming at us from the state. We have to prepare. We absolutely have to prepare for expenditures to hit this school district that we don't even know about yet. There is no doubt. Two off the top of my head, and please understand that I support a minimum salary for teachers. I certainly do. But there are areas that bill will not cover. So if that becomes a law, that this district will have to find ways to do that. And right now, that's not in the budget. There's also some legislation right now about the, not legislation, but there's a potential for there to be a hike in officials for sporting events. If that comes down, that will be an item that has not been planned for. So we will have to find dollars for that. So having a reserve is extremely important. It's not my money, it's not your money, but it's our money. And we have to make sure that we're looking after it the way that our constituents would expect us to. And part of our job is to pass the baton to the next generation of school board members and superintendent to make sure that those funds are there. And Ms. Wright, there was a little more to your question. Would you mind repeating that?
Our funding budget concerns are paramount to the continuing success of the district. Please describe the process you have used when budget cuts have been necessary, and please expand on your position related to budget reserve.
When I look at budget cuts and budgets in general, there are really three areas. There's human resources, which is where we spend a large portion of our money. There's a teaching and learning component, and there's also an operation piece. I've described some of the processes with you for operations and how we've saved some of those monies, but I'd like to address the teaching and learning piece. The teaching and learning piece, we throw lots of money sometimes at curriculum, and that's not just a Volusia thing. That's across the country. We throw a lot. I'll share with you that we've implemented a practice that we must use 100% of all online licenses in Osceola County. In the first year alone, we saved $780,000 by making sure that we did that. When it comes to adopting high-quality materials, I want my high-impact teachers, my very, very best, making those selections for those materials, because that's one of the things that all of our teachers have to be able to move instruction, is good materials. But once that's done and we've selected that, I want my procurement team to go to work on them. I want my procurement team to go to work on the vendors to make sure that they're getting us the very best deal that they can, because there is no silver bullet with curriculum. There's nothing out there. It's going to be the teacher that makes the difference. So the last area that I want to cut would be human resources. However, remember I talked about those position reviews. As a new position is vacated, there has got to be dialogue. Does that position still serve the purpose or is it something that we can abscond? I believe in budget neutrality. And what I mean by that is where you spend somewhere, you're saving somewhere else. That helps save for a rainy day. And so I truly believe that those position reviews in HR, through the HR component, are extremely important. I don't want one person making that decision. I want that to come to cabinet so that we can have discussion and what is that impact. And one of the things that I will do for you as a board is anytime I bring you a position of any kind, there will be a fiscal impact and a funding source of where that position is being paid for.
Thank you. Tell us about the largest critical budgetary decision you made. What was the situation? What decision did you make, and how were you involved? What analysis of information did you use to gather support for your decision? And what was the impact of your decision? So I'll reread it for you.
Sure, go ahead.
Tell us about the largest critical budgetary decision you made. Number one, what was the situation?
So I'm going to say it was probably in Orange County Public Schools. There was an opportunity for us to streamline. Orange County Public Schools, one of the initiatives that the superintendent charged me with was to bring teaching and learning together as one. Because it was such a large district, there were five learning communities, and we noticed that there were differences in each learning community. So one of the things that she had charged me with was to make sure that as mobility happened, that there was equity amongst the learning communities for all of our students to get the same opportunities. And what we realized was that we had a group of resource teachers that were in the district, and not that they weren't qualified, they were. But we needed to make sure that we had the very best to do more with less. So one of the things that we did is we redesigned that HR position of a resource teacher for the teaching and learning division and turned it into a program specialist position. So it was a higher caliber position, but it was also a position that would do more for their job to unify the entire district. That meant that 138 instructional coaches had the opportunity to apply for about 50 positions. They were going to have jobs in our district, but they weren't going to have those jobs. And so we had to make it was a situation where we had to create a new job description. We had to have people apply for those jobs. Well, you know, 50 of them were happy, and 80 were not because they didn't get the job. But it was a chance for us to restructure. We had those positions and those vacancies, so it was a cost savings. Those positions existed as vacancies in school sites, so those folks that did not get selected had to go back to schools. But it was a multi-million dollar savings for us.
Okay. That's it for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. My turn.
Yes, sir.
So you've been a principal, and you've been many things after that. What makes an effective school?
Leadership. Leadership, consistency of leadership, and consistency of staff. Teachers don't follow money. Teachers follow leaders. Close your eyes for a second. You don't have to really close your eyes. But think about the best job you ever had. I can almost guarantee you worked for a boss that you really respected. Leadership absolutely matters. One of the things that I would want to do as your superintendent is I would want to get a jump start. If we have people that are retiring this year, I want to post the jobs in January. I want the new principal that's going to be a part of that school to make the hire because those teachers are invested in their principals. They want to stay with them. And by June, I want every school leadership position that we know of in place so that they can use the summer to plan. I think that leadership is the number one thing. I think the teachers being able to stay at that school with that leader are important. In Osceola County, we have not lined up principals and shifted them to the right every 3 years. We've allowed them, as long as they're continuing to perform, to build a culture, to build something that they can be proud of, to build their legacy. And their teachers stay with them. And I think that's very powerful.
So let's stick with that. So how do you evaluate effectiveness?
number one factor is their students. Are their students excelling? Are they performing? How does the community feel about the principals? You know, we do a lot of surveys to find out. You know, is there success? Is there retention at that school? Do I have 20 and 30 teachers leaving every single solitary year? Am I constantly having vacancies in the middle of the year? Those are all factors and signs for me about leadership in a school.
What do you feel is the single most important piece of data that will drive our district forward?
I'm going to tell you, I'll backwards, Matt, I think it's the graduation rate. I really do. That to me is, as we look as educators, I attend every single graduation, and I would here in Volusia County too. When those kids cross that stage, our folks have done what they were supposed to do. The challenge is I want every kid to cross the stage with a plan for something next. But that graduation point has to be where the high schools go, so does the district. And I do believe that that certainly is the responsibility of elementary and middle school principals and teachers as well. They all own that, getting that child across that stage, but that would be the single metric that I would use.
You're right about graduation, that's for sure. Well, let's talk about the test scores. What strategies would you introduce to raise the test scores in reading levels of the lowest quartile?
So there's been a great research study, so I'm going to share with you what it says. Okay, there are four essential areas that teachers have got to have for students to really excel. Number one, they have to have standard-based curriculum and provide grade-appropriate assignments. Remember the boxes that I talked about earlier? Even if a kid is one or two boxes behind, they have to prepare and have to support with grade-appropriate assignments, because test scores are going to come up, and we're going to expect them to run a marathon when they've only been training with a mile. So we've got to make sure they have appropriate assignments. Number two, we have got to make sure that there is high-quality instruction in every single classroom. Number three, we've got to make sure that the students themselves are engaged in learning. And you can see this when you walk into classrooms. Are students sitting in rows as islands, or are they collaborating with one another, having great discourse and conversations about what it is they're learning? Are they engaged in the thinking about what they're learning? And do teachers have high expectations for them? I'll share with you that one of my greatest prides in 28 years in this business was opening Junta Middle School as the principal. And the reason I want to share that with you, because I think it paints a picture. When I was appointed to that school, a senior member of the district office came up to congratulate me. And he didn't know he was saying something wrong, but he did. All the schools around the area were CDs and a couple were Fs. And he said to me, "Fritz, just don't get an F." Now, he was talking about my kids. So I went back, and the first leaders that I hired at that school, we sat down and said, "Talk to me about these children. Let's talk about what we want them to be." And we wanted them to be giants. So giants became who we were. And then we wanted them to think big. We opened that school with the majority of students being level ones and twos and over 200 retentions. By year two, that school was an A school. They had met adequately yearly progress, and 50% of the students were in advanced classes. They thought big. So to me, that's what all means all.
I asked you about the strategies for the lowest quartile.
Yes.
And I didn't necessarily break it down elementary, middle, or high school. Would you care to do that now?
Yeah, I will share with you those four essential ingredients that I mentioned are for all three levels.
Sure.
But our elementary schools in particular are seven on the lowest 300. I think there are certain things that we have to do. One of those, I would bring a process to those schools this first year called stock take. And what that would be is that would be regular monitoring of the student performance paying close attention to those bottom quartiles. It would be regular monitoring every 2 weeks from now until the end of the year. And we would have fluid interventions. And what I mean by that is, let's propose you were a fourth grade student sitting in a math class and you were struggling with fractions and you needed help today because you weren't getting it. The time to intervene is today. So in elementary school, we have that triple I period. But what if you got fractions after that triple I experience and you started accelerating and going ahead? Fluid interventions means that you can remediate today and accelerate tomorrow. Some of the flaws that I see at the secondary level is when we remediate a child, we do it at a year at a time. We tell a student because they were a level one on the FSA that they have to be in intensive reading for the entire year. And I know why we do that. But do we ever really pulse check and try to accelerate that student throughout the year? It's one assessment, it's one time, and we allow them to do that. Our high schools have really started working in Osceola County to be able to address that. So as you address that bottom quartile, as kids are more successful, you give them more opportunities to be successful. You don't continue to drill and kill them forever.
And explain your position at middle school, too.
So middle school is a unique opportunity. I will share with you that we piloted a program, and I've not seen any like it anywhere else. We call it Jumpstart. You know, when a child is retained somewhere between third grade and eighth grade, there's an 80% shot that that child's not going to walk across the stage. So Jumpstart is a program that we've taken select students, because there could be reasons they were retained. They could have had some trauma in their lives. But we've taken select students, and we've taken sixth grade and seventh grade and put them together in 1 year. And we don't do this across the board, but we've done it with select students, and we've got two schools doing it right now in Osceola County. And we've taken students that are behind, and by the time they get to eighth grade, they're in algebra. So now we've taken students that are behind, and we've increased their opportunities to go to college. That's also an opportunity in middle school to push mathematics and science in foreign language. That bottom quartile group of students have skills, and it's a really great opportunity for us to push and accelerate the mathematics. If we take sixth and seventh grade math and push it more together, we can get those students prepared for algebra in eighth grade. The reason that's so important is if you follow statistics and correlations, students that take algebra in eighth grade will graduate. When you're a ninth grade student taking algebra in an intensive reading class, and you get an F in one of those classes, the odds are stacked against you that you'll ever walk across that stage. Part of what we need to do in middle school is make sure that we're preparing them for high school.
Great. Board members, excuse me, we're running good on time, so you'll be able to ask another question. So kind of keep that in mind. Let me ask you, if you got this job, you started in January.
Yes, sir.
So what decisions, what would be happening in January? What would be happening in April? What would be happening in June? Quickly.
Okay. I would start November 13th, just so you know.
Without a contract, I'm assuming.
Yeah, there are certain things that have to get done. We have to make sure that those seven schools move, those seven elementary schools absolutely move. That we have to make sure that our meetings are set as board members and superintendents so that we can start those communications right away. And I would like to start listening tours as soon as the contract was ratified, so that's something I'd want to do. In January, I would want to make sure that we have that one message going with our teaching and learning, so that our folks at the schools can truly understand the way of our work. I'd want to make sure that by February, we had a clear, February and March, we had a clear process for our budget allocations so that we could get a jump start on hiring. By April, I would want to make sure that we've gone through the district line items and make sure that all of those are starting to focus. And in April, I'd like to be able to come back April and May to this board and tell you what I've learned on our listening tours and the visits that I've been to, and get your direction on whether or not you would like to revise our strategic plan, continue our strategic plan, or completely reconstruct our strategic plan. And if the idea is to reconstruct a strategic plan, then we would have to get started with stakeholder input at that point in time so that we would be ready for the next school year. By May and June, I'd like to have all administrators, assistant principals, and principals in their slots for the next school year. I think that's critical. I would like to open the doors for hiring starting in January. In fact, first thing that we will do is every intern that is interning with us in January, as long as they pass their internship, we'll give them a conditional employment right then and there, because I want them to stay here in Volusia with us rather than be lured away and go somewhere else. I think that that will be critical for us. I think another thing that we need to do in June is those first-year teachers that we have, and we would be strategic about where we would do that, but schools of concern and struggle that still exist, I would want to bring those teachers on in June so that we could keep them warm with Volusia County. I'd like to bring them on and have them partner with a master teacher as we go through our summer programs, and then spend the rest of the time training them on curriculum, because I think retention is extremely important, and I think during pre-planning, our first-year teachers struggle with not having enough time to get everything in that they need. And then I would come to you after our test scores came out, and I would ask this board to help prioritize where we would spend our money. Our budget really, I heard this at a government finance conference that I went to last year, that our budget is our educational vision in numerical form. And so as the board, I would want you to be able to tell us and prioritize how we would spend the next year's budget as it relates to that strategic plan. The other thing I believe is every dollar we spend should go back to that plan in some way, and we should be able to quantify that.
Thank you. All right, board members, you ready to go with your questions? So we'll put like a three-minute or four. I think three. We better go to three now. Okay, so 3 minutes for each question. And Ms. Cuthbert, go ahead.
Yeah, there's the one I didn't get to ask. So about curriculum and instruction. Tell us the time that you have worked through with others or used an out-of-the-box approach to assist district achieve academic success.
An out-of-the-box approach. Well, I will tell you some things that I'm very, very proud of. An out-of-the-box approach. Osceola County was the only district in 2017 to be awarded College Board's AP Honor Roll District. Very pleased and proud of our teachers and our folks for doing that. What that meant for us is that we had to look at advanced placement differently. We had to make sure that we were really opening access for our students. And that involves a lot of conversations, because I got to tell you, sometimes it's not the students that are afraid, it's the adults that are afraid. So making sure that we had those conversations, and that involved a lot of conversations. Sitting down with teachers, principals, they were worried that putting certain students in classes would hinder their school grade. We had to work our way through that. We had to make sure that we were talking about what was best for our students. That's what started the conversation about opening up other opportunities. That 80% acceleration, that's an out-of-the-box idea. That's an out-of-the-box idea, and, you know, you have to have lots of conversations to help people understand, well, what if this was your child? I do a lot of that. Because when you personalize it like that, it becomes real, and you would want the adult to advocate for your child. So I'm also proud that when I was the first chief academic officer in Orange County Public Schools, we also won the AP Honor Roll District up there. And in 2014, we won the Distinguished Broad Prize for Urban Education. And that was for narrowing the achievement gap for our students, and it awarded them $500,000 worth of scholarships.
Thank you. Mr. Cologne.
Great. So I've asked all my questions. So I have a question. So I've often felt that we were not the providers of the news, and realizing we can't beat social media. Social media is fast. How comfortable do you feel, or how do you envision your role with the media, newspapers, and those folks who get the information to our stakeholders, and how we can be the source of the message rather than allowing others to be so?
Well, I think school districts that do a good job with that, the superintendent's not afraid to get on camera themselves. I think that's pretty important, and Kelly's phenomenal, and there's times that she can handle that, but there's other times that I need to be the face of the school district. One of the things that I can assure this board is even in tough times, you'll see a decor of diplomacy coming from me. Transparency is extremely important. One of the things that I highlight is no surprises. Part of that is being proactive. Part of that is just being transparent. And if something is wrong and we've made a mistake, owning it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Colon. Ms. Haynes.
So you answered all of mine, but I have an extra one. What is your plan for boosting and keeping morale among employees high?
I'm going to go back to something I said because I still think this is the right answer. I think consistent quality leadership in our schools is number one. I do have a couple areas that I'd like to address, though. I don't know if it would be something that this board feels is appropriate or not, but something that might be important is customer service. Customer service is an area that I think sometimes even in our own internal organization, if a teacher is frustrated and trying to get answers or a principal's trying to get answers and they feel like they're not getting that, sometimes it's a straw that breaks the camel's back. I've had that experience with parents where they've come and they've sat with me and they've said, you know, this is a little thing, but it's just the end thing. We've been in schools for 8 years, and this is the last straw. I think that's really important. I think another thing for morale is, you know, sometimes you got to find a way to say yes. And rather than putting up barriers, let's see how we can find a way to come to a mutual agreement and find a way to say yes. I think part of the time morale is down is because people feel like if I ask the question, I'm going to get told no. Well, not necessarily. And that comes from that leadership piece that we have to give principals, we have to give leaders in schools sometimes permission to say yes. And if they understand that clear communication coming from the top, that one message, they'll know when they can say yes and when they can't.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. Ms. Wright.
I asked all of my questions, but you said something that actually sparked my interest. You were attending a conference, and you heard at that conference about the budget being the educational
vision.
That's right. Elaborate on that.
Where you spend your money, you'll show your priorities.
And so, you the superintendent, what would be your vision and what would be your priorities that you would bring to us?
Priorities number one are make sure that, I'm going to go back to those four essentials, that our teachers have what they need to make sure that they're able to help our students produce. I want to make sure that we have the right materials in their hands. I want to make sure that we're training them with the right instructional strategies. I want to make sure that they've got the tools to do the job. You know, at Wharton High School, which was my last principalship after Junta. Remember, Junta was the place where the motto was think big. At Wharton High School, they had been a C forever. And when I was moved there, the teachers had a very candid conversation with me. They were tired of being a C. And so the conversation went, and this is the days before we got points for graduation and acceleration. This is FCAT time. What they did is they said they needed things, and we made sure they got things. They taught every single class like it was a rigorous honors-level class, even if it wasn't. In 1 year, that school was 2 points from an A because teachers had what they needed in the classrooms. They taught it at such a high level in quality instruction, and they had their support from their leader, which was me. So where we would spend the money would be on our kids through our teachers. That would be a priority number one for me.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. All right. We are down to the closing comment time. Thank you for being so concise with your answers, and thank you, board members, for doing the same with your questioning. I have a couple of things. We have a little bit of time, so first question would be just to ask you right off the top here. Is there anything else the board you feel needs to know about you as we face this very important decision?
You have a very important decision. There is no doubt. I hope you can see where my passions are, my why. You know, I pointed out to you earlier, not a day goes by that I don't think about Amanda, John, Luke, or Michael. And it's because those kids taught me a lot. I'm not going to tell you they were the easiest. In fact, on day one, when my teacher said to me, the master teacher said to me, he said, Mr. Fritz, when you walk outside and take John to PE, keep your eyes on him. So I made John walk next to me, and we walked outside. And I literally turned to talk to Amanda, and then I hear John yelling to me 30 feet from the air. He's up a tree. He had climbed the tree standing next to me. And panicking because it was 1 hour into the job, the teacher that the PE teacher that was organizing the kickball game said, "John, you're up. Come down." John got out of the tree super quick. So when I walked back to Rick, the teacher, he said, "So how was it?" I said, "John climbed a tree." He says, "I told you to keep your eye on him." The why is there, and it has never changed, and literally have walked every step and every level in a school system. And have had success. I've spent 17 years in Hillsborough County Schools, 11 the last 11 as a cabinet member, and most recently as number two. I understand the why. I understand the importance of a strong system to make sure that our end users have what it is they need to do their job and the clarity that they need to understand what the district is asking of them. And as board members in our community, I get what it means about no surprises. That's transparency, nothing last minute, making sure that we have forethought. To share with you, I mean, if I'm lucky enough to get this job, I've got November 13th through January 1st planned. There are things that I want to get done to start in January to be ready to roll. One's to make sure I have appointments with you. Two, I want listening tours set up. And three, I really want to make sure that we get those seven schools where they're supposed to be. At the elementary level.
Okay, well, that wraps it up for us. I just want to thank you, and I mean this on behalf of the board, thank you so much for having such an amazing career, for the dedication that you obviously have to students and in all the places where you have been. It's certainly is to be commended, and we thank you once again. Just in case you didn't know, the board will be meeting on November the 12th to make this very important, and I'm sure which will become a very difficult decision.
Yes.
But we got to make it, and yes. We will make it on November the 12th. Thank you again for being here, and
thank you.
I hope you enjoy your time here in Volusia County. Don't forget the reception this evening. And tomorrow, I think you're going to have a little tour, too. You'll be seeing three schools, I think, tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
Tomorrow. That's right. Tomorrow. Yes. I'm just the chair. I don't know anything. But anyway, enjoy your time here in Volusia County, and we'll see you later this evening.
Thank you.
All right, so we're in recess until 12:45. Good afternoon, everyone, and we are back in session once again. Just for those who have just walked in or perhaps are listening right now via the internet, let you know what has taken place so far today. At 10 o'clock, the board interviewed Dr. Ronald Scott Fritz, currently from Osceola County. In a few minutes, we'll be interviewing Dr. Peter Licata from Palm Beach County. And following Dr. Licata's interview, we'll have a 15-minute break, and then we will convene to interview Dr. David Moore from Miami-Dade County. So at this time, if Dr. Licata is ready, we will have Dr. Licata enter the room.
Dr. Licata.
Dr. Licata. Normally I'd say the seat's hot, but it's not because you're in this, what do we call it, the cold storage room today, I think. But so the
it's a little chilly.
Nice,
yes,
it's a little chilly
for a Florida
here.
Boy. It's very chilly.
Yeah, it is good. Trying to keep everybody alert, I guess, in here today. Dr. Licata, we're so glad that you're here.
I'm
going
to
take a few minutes to introduce the folks around us today. And so I'll begin with introducing school board member from District 3, Ms. Linda Cuthbert. And next to her, school board member from District 5, Mr. Ruben Colon. Over here is our agency clerk, Connie Spire, school board member from District 1, Jamie Haynes. And our vice chair and school board member from District 2 is Ms. Ida Wright. Our chief financial officer is sitting here, and that is Ms. Deborah Muller. I am the chair, and my name is Carl Persis, and it's once again so nice of you to come from beautiful Palm Beach, Florida, and to be up here. Did you have a nice stay last night?
It's been phenomenal. Reminds me of Palm Beach County about 30 years ago. There was room to drive. There's farms. It's not a house in every corner. Difference is people smile a lot more here sometimes.
Yeah.
They wave, and your traffic is a lot more manageable, shall we say.
Yes.
But I love Palm Beach County, but this is a beautiful place. My wife and I drove over the bridge the other day. She saw me grab the wheel a little tighter, and she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "This really looks like a place we could stop at."
Yeah, isn't that great? Dr. Cloud, if you'll just pull that microphone a little bit closer to you. There we go. I want to take also a second to introduce some of the folks that are in the audience. It's always good to know who is sitting behind you, right? So let me start with, I didn't introduce them last time, but Pat Drago and Patricia Crosby, they're both here from the League of Women Voters. All right, well, now that you're up, now you're going to have to do this for everybody. Elizabeth Albert, she is the president of our Teachers Association. Carol Sawyer, Carol's there. She's the head of our AFSCME union. Let me see who I get here. Greg Aiken is right over here. He's chief for operations there, Mr. Aiken. Stacy Manning is our general counsel. And he is there as well. So thank you all for being in the audience. And we will go ahead then and start with our opening questions, just so you get an idea of the time frame on this. I'm going to ask you a couple of questions, and then we're going to go around. Each board member has questions. We've allotted about 12 minutes per board. And if we don't use all that a lot of time, then we'll be able to go around perhaps and ask another question. So, and then at the end of all this, we'll certainly give you time for any closing comments that you would like to make and or any questions about the process or questions to the board you may have after all of this. Feel free to ask, okay? I don't want you to feel like we're press for time, but we are kind of on a schedule, okay? So the first question to you, Dr. Licata, is what is the most important part of the superintendent's job, and why do you think so?
I believe the most important part of the superintendent's job is being the education leader and CEO of the school district. As superintendent, he or she must model every ethical, every movement, every discussion, every decision based on, predicated on, best for all people. That's their role, he or she. And it's important that that is the icon that everyone reaches for and sees that this is the model of every employee in the district.
Peter, that am I back?
There we go.
Wow. If they don't have a leader that they see what models the expectations every single day and every action, then they're lost. They don't have a direction, and they choose their own. And we have to face the district as a team. We can't do it individually.
And I appreciate you saying that. And why do you feel that's so important?
Leadership is about making everyone around you better. And when you model that and when you give everyone their targeted goal, what's best for every child, the business community gets involved. The school gets involved. The local universities get involved. The parents get involved. And when you have that model and you know that that person leading the district is showing everyone the expectations and the goals, and the one unified voice that comes from the board and the team, then we become a unified force that does do best for all children.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. My next question is, as we select a new superintendent, what are the top three strengths, attributes you believe you bring that our district could benefit from?
Well, I don't know if I can count this as one of them, but it's that beautiful woman over there, my wife, Judith Licata.
That's a good move, Dr. Licata.
Yeah,
that's a good move.
I'm no dummy. But my biggest strength is relationships. I have a lot of strengths, but that stands out clearly. I think if you speak with everyone in the district office that I was in for almost 9 years and then moved to the regional office, I think everyone from the three Lewises that are the custodians on each floor to the cafeteria folks and every staff member, I made it a point to make sure they understood that I heard what they said and that they were important. And speaking to people and listening probably is my best. So when you say communication or relationships, listening to people and not just waiting for them to stop talking so you can put your viewpoint in, listening to them and understanding what they're saying and then build your response from that, not have a predisposed response as we see so much in social media and such, to listen to people. So that's my strength. The other one is organizational strength, organizational awareness, and organizational acuity towards processes and systems. You cannot run an efficient organization that's limited funds with finite money from the state and have a disorganized or not a good process for everything. You know, you have to put a system in place for people to understand what their direction is, and that process has to be clearly spelled out. And I have put those systems and processes in place over and over and over again, everywhere I've been, and my success is detailed in the resumes. But it's not just happenstance. You can be great at relationships, but you still have to be able to put pen to paper and still be able to have organizational strengths to make sure students understand they're getting the very best in every school as they move along, not just in some schools. And finally, I would have to say, you're asking for three, so I'm going to shut it down to three. I would have to say the ability to reach for every child. My history is very clear that closing the achievement gap was a strength of mine, offering multiple opportunities for areas in our district that didn't used to get those opportunities. The children that looked similar were afforded now opportunities that every other child was getting. And that's important. But I didn't lower the ceiling to close the achievement gap. You can't raise the floor by lowering the ceiling. You have to do both at the same time. And every kid is every kid. We can't forget about the kids that are just flying off the charts, doing so well. We have to make sure they're engaged. But we know that most of our attention also has to be the kids who need to catch up. We need to be that gap. So closing that achievement gap and understanding what it takes and making sure that the students have every opportunity. So an equitable stance at looking at closing the achievement gap. So those three I could limit it to because I'm real comfortable with those three.
Thank you so much. All right. We're going to start our questioning now from other board members, and we'll begin with Ms. Cuthbert.
Curriculum and student achievement. What innovative ideas might you have on the tip of your fingers there for Volusia County schools to address to increase our graduation rates across all subpopulations?
So I looked at the graduation rate and I looked at some of the college readiness pieces. Many students aren't being exposed, and this is certainly in no way, shape, or form a negative towards the district, but there are many opportunities for students to be taking advanced in college courses that are not offered them right now. That would be conquered simply through a master schedule analysis before the prior year. We've been gatekeepers on certain students getting through to college-level advanced courses or acceleration courses. We need to look from the district and from the area offices and say, let's see your master schedule. Let's see what kids potentially could do well here. Just because they scored a certain score on the FSA shouldn't mean they shouldn't be allowed to even attempt to try. It's our job to give them an opportunity to try. So when you look at the offering the opportunity, one of the weaknesses in your areas for graduation rate was, you know, getting college and career ready. There's also the idea that students that are at risk need to be designated as focus students. And you can't wait till the December of their 12th grade year. You have to start looking at their freshman year, because, and I believe you were a high school teacher. Kids don't do well in 9th grade. That's what starts there. That starts that process. It's not in 12th grade they drop out. It starts in 9th grade. As a high school principal, my 9th grade was the most important, because by the time they got to 12th grade, I had a handful of kids I could pay attention to all the time to make sure they graduate. But when they come in as 9th graders, if you lose them then, it's really hard to get them back. So we would do some transitioning as well. When we see an 8th grader who's moving on to 9th grade, it's behind already. And the statistics are there. If they've been suspended multiple times, if they're absent more than 10 days, their graduation chances drop down into the 30s if they've been multiple suspensions. Those are the kids we bring in early. Those are the students we say, listen, come on in. We're going to get you a head start. We're going to show you everything about this high school, where to get extra help, where's your lunch, where's your locker, what are the rules, here's your classrooms. Those are the schedules we work on first to make sure they're comfortable and they understand that this is their high school and they're going to be successful and they have a good support group around. So I opened up a 9th grade academy when I became high school principal, and the graduation rate was 67%. I say that because it's embarrassing. When I first showed up, within 4 years it was 89%, simply by having relationships with every student and targeting every student. I was fortunate. It was a small high school. There was only about 1,800 kids in there, and I know that's not small by many standards, but I was able to understand every child. I made sure I knew every kid. And I think if you talk to any of those students who still call me, and they're now in their 30s, they'll tell you the same thing. And that's important, making sure they know everyone knows who they are. And that 9th grade academy came through, and that fourth year they came through high school, we left it at 89%. The African-American rate was in the 50s. The Hispanic rate was in the low 60s. And by the end, we were all in the 89 percentile. And that, to me, is still one of my best accomplishments. So I hope I'm not ruining a question later on in the day. But that would be one of the main things. Get a master schedule analysis together. Look at students who have opportunities that normally don't get opportunities. And make sure we target our freshmen as they come through.
Thank you. As the lead learner of a large school district, how would you influence or create a culture that fosters inclusion, the inclusion of high expectations, to close the achievement gap across all our subgroups, such as students with disabilities, students of low social economic situations, and students of all racial groups? I think you touched a bit.
So I think I touched on students with diversity and poverty and then the achievement gap. Let's look at the other two groups, since I think I covered some of it, all of it. Let's talk about our ELL students. ELL students come here, and I think you're about 15 or 14% in here. They come here, and we assess them with English test-taking skills for the most part, and then we designate where they're going. And that is a good way to start. But just because they don't speak our language doesn't mean they don't know technology or they don't know how to get an industry certification, or maybe they can be in a Spanish AP course if they speak Spanish. I think we need to look at the ELL students immediately, because just because they don't speak our language as a native language speaker, it doesn't mean they don't have the opportunity to show how smart they are and exceed what our expectations are, and that's what we want. As far as ESE, much the same. ESE students are near and dear to my heart, without a doubt. My wife is an ESE teacher for many years, so I understand that. They should be afforded the same opportunity through inclusions and making sure paraprofessionals are in the classroom. Get our resources together and make sure that they get that extra attention. Don't seclude them. Include them. And make sure they have opportunities to focus on getting resources that maybe they are in multiple categories. And you have to pay attention to if a child has multiple marks against them, if they're ESE, if they're in poverty. We know these are indicators of a child that's at risk already. I think every child is at risk, but these are at risk a little bit more. And when you get to that place, you better have resources for them, and we need to provide that. And if we give them the opportunity in advanced courses, if we give them the opportunity in an industry certification, in a CTE course, let's support them. Let's get them through that.
Thank you. Could you tell us a time when you've worked with others or used an out-of-the-box approach to achieve academic success?
I'm hoping I'm not ruining this, because this is a great answer or a great question. About 6 years ago, I was head of the choice department in CTE and charters, and I realized that we were not tapping every resource we needed. I realized that we were in a place that we were on average when it came to advanced courses, especially before it was even part of the grading system, actually, for middle school. We're just right about there. So I decided that we would invest our Perkins money into creating labs for our middle schools. Computer labs, 32 at a time, or 34, because, you know, two are always broken. You put 32 kids in the class, and we would open up industry certifications for middle school, and we did it in every middle school. Some of the middle schools already had their computer labs. We know what those schools look like. The schools that didn't have them, we sort of know what they look like, and that was not going to be a barrier. So I sort of got a tilted head look at Cabinet one day when I said I was going to do this, and the superintendent said, go with it. As long as it doesn't cost any more money, go with it. So we were able to work some things through that. So now we have computer labs in every middle school, and we instituted a technology academy in those schools. And we had the vendor CIW come in, and I'm sorry if I'm not supposed to speak about vendors here, unfortunately. And they came in and did their own professional development. They trained our teachers. We found we had a lot of business ed teachers where that was sort of not popular in middle school anymore, but the certification to teach these courses was a business. So now we train teachers that were almost becoming extinct because those courses, typing was not one of those courses that we taught anymore. Not only did we put in an academy, technology academy, in every single middle school, all 34 of them. We supplied labs for about 10 of them. We were 25%, 2 years ago, 25% of all industry certifications earned in the state of Florida in middle school just in Palm Beach County. So we were knocking it out of the park. I got the tilted head look from the rest of the folks saying, you're putting industry certification in the middle school. These kids are smart. You know, children today learn through technology. We learn technology as adults. We learn technology. They learn through technology. And that was a recognition I saw right away. So you'll see a lot of those type of answers from me because I don't think it was that out of the box. It was just forward thinking. Out of the box sometimes scares me, but it was more forward thinking and providing opportunities for everyone.
And that led right into my next one. I don't have to ask sure. The next one because I asked, how do you envision student learning that's online, whether it's STEM or CTE? And the last couple of questions, anything you want to add to
that? Yeah, I'd like to add to that. Being overseeing as assistant soup, overseeing virtual education for the last 3 years, and being part of the CTE, being the major leader of the CTE, we have to be careful. We have to be careful about how we see online learning. We have to understand that students should only see an hour a week in online learning unless it's a direct virtual course, because obviously you have to spend all the time in front of it. But when we're in a classroom and even sort of a hybrid environment with the teacher monitoring what's going on, we have to be very careful that we're not letting the student run away with what they have in front of them and make sure we have accountability systems and exit points that the teacher can follow along and manage that. And that's the managing console at their desk, which most systems have now, which, again, the program I spoke of before in middle school has, and you can see the monitoring of the students. But I think we have to be very careful with screen time. The students, they get enough screen time. We know a lot of it is not educational, but it's still screen time. And we cannot discount the importance of a teacher in front of students instructing them. Mm-hmm. There is no replacement for that. There will never be a replacement, at least in my lifetime. So you can't replace that input and that relationship a teacher provides. And I'm all for moving forward with technology and online education and virtual education, but we have to be very deliberate in our practice and make sure we're understanding that too much is actually a declining rate, as the studies will show.
Thank you. And my last question, how would you assist teachers or school principals and campuses in handling the too many distractions that are going on in the schools right now, like drills, special assemblies, events, fairs, concerts, pull-out meetings, a lot of kids are pulled out, special events, guest speakers, that any school day brings while preserving, thus supporting the academic learning time and that focus in our schools?
That's a difficult question to answer because the more we
move, the best for last.
Yes, it's difficult because we can't control most of that. We can't control the outside influences in our school. We can control what goes on in our school, and with a system and a process. And let me give you an example. As a high school principal, I knew that when I was first there, the first couple of weeks, I noticed we were interrupting classes. We were making announcements. We had a lot of non-academic things that could have been done at different times. I became the events coordinator. I know that's not a glorious title, but every event had to be scheduled for me and approved by me. There were going to be no announcements made during school day. They were only going to be done at the end of first hour for the 5 minutes, 8 minutes actually, allotted, and that was it. Any other important announcement had to come from me, and I would make it. That was one of the biggest things, because as a teacher, you can understand, getting interrupted in the middle of a lesson, it throws everybody off. And that system was put in place. And then when I became the events coordinator of the school, and I'm not a micromanager in any way, it appeared that we had a lot less activities during that time. All of a sudden, they started decreasing. Now, as far as drills, and that's the tough part of the question. You know, the state mandates we do so many drills every year, whether it be fire or safety drills. That's what we've been dealt. It's a fair display of why we should have them. My office is exactly 6 miles from Stoneman Douglas. I understand that. A lot of our communities were involved in that. And when you look at that, you understand why. But that has to be coordinated properly. It doesn't mean you just slam them in at the end of the week when it's 10 days, when the first 2 weeks are up or the first month is up. You coordinate them appropriately. And you work with your teachers and your staff and say, when is the best time? And this is when your teacher cabinet, and I had a teacher cabinet, when is the best time? Let's make sure we're not interrupting lessons. That's important, and that's key. We can control what we control. We can't control outside influences. So I hope that answers your question.
Yes, sir, it does. Thank you so much. Mr. Persons.
Thank you, Ms. Cuthbert. And now, Mr. Ruben Colon.
Okay, so I'm going to be speaking about internal and external communication. My first question is, how would you ensure that the school board be informed on important matters?
So part of my 100-day plan, that is a draft, discusses communication at length. It talks about the idea that for the first 100 days, you're going to get a voicemail from me every day. You don't have to answer your phone. It'll be on there. And it'll discuss what the day went like. When it comes to important matters or crises, that's a different story. There has to be a central key communicator piece. And I know we have a director of communications who's absolutely wonderful over there. There she is. Very hospitable. Thank you. That has to be key, that's the resource. That's the point that everything goes to in crisis. I want schools to be able to display how great they are. I want schools to be able to show everyone how great some of the kids are doing, what's going on. Crisis time needs to come directly to communications and myself and the second in charge, whoever that would be, as when I become superintendent somewhere, hopefully right here. And that's important because now you have three people that are on the clock all the time, and I think she understands that. And when you have that direct point, then it's immediate phone calls, and it goes to the board chair first, the vice chair, and then so on. If it can be put in a voicemail that we've had something go on at school, everything's fine, it was a false alarm, that's a voicemail to you every day. You click it on at your time. You don't have to answer it. It comes to you. You're up to date. You have questions on it, then you can call me back on that. But keeping you informed for those first few months is very, very important, mostly because you can see what I'm doing, and you can help direct me on what you feel your vision is as a school board on what I need to pay attention to maybe more that I'm not seeing. So that's external communication. Internal communication. Anything of significance and policy change comes here, and that comes through my office. And there's a tree. Through board docs, you'll see the tree at the bottom, and we use board docs as well. And that tree has to be very well defined. And that person who signs that bottom that says, this is approved, moving to the next, they are held accountable that they've read every word and they understand that it is 2019, it's not 2018, because then it has to go back. That is clear. That process must be very clear, and there's part of that systems and processes. It must go through that tree, and it must be signed by them in a timely manner. He or she who's in charge of that area has to be absolutely accountable as it moves through. Internal communications for other issues outside of policy changes has to go through the proper channels, and if it's a school-related issue, it goes through the area office. I'm used to the area office pattern as a regional. We're a regional, not an area. And having 60 schools under me, it goes to my instructional superintendents, which I have four of them, and then it comes to me. If it's significant enough, then I move it up to our director of communications. But internally, it goes through my instructional superintendents to me. And with that relationship and communication piece I have with my leaders, they know when it's time to tell me something, and they know it's time. So it's about being open, transparent, and honest, but also knowing who's your next phone call. And sometimes it's not an email. It's not a text. It's a phone call. So that environment will be very clear, because you as the board have to stand in front of your constituents and make sure they're informed of everything as well.
Great, thank you. When a new superintendent is hired, we want to make sure the transition is smooth as possible for everyone. How would you help both the educational community and the community at large adjust to the new governing style that will come with the new superintendent?
I believe that as a leader or a superintendent, I work for the entire district. That can't be accomplished on how everyone feels about that unless I go to the community first. And as I start in that transition, I would make sure that I'm available to them in their community, not on my terms, on their terms, in their churches, in their communities, every community that needs to be heard. It's easier for me to go there and let them be comfortable in their home. And if that means teachers and business leaders and moms and dads and grandmas and grandpas, which I am, proud grandpa. I know you're looking at me saying, wait, he's way too young to have a grandchild. At least I say that to myself. You don't have to do that. I say it to myself every day. But it's important we go to there because we do hear from the same communities. It's important we hear from every community, but sometimes we hear from the same community often, and sometimes we never hear from certain communities. So once I get a feel for that, and once we do group sessions with them and let them work in work groups with what they want to see, you know, what is really good in this district? What is the best thing in this district so I don't touch it? What are we doing really well that needs to be maybe pushed a little bit more? Let me touch that. And what do we need to see that we could do better? And what do they want to see better? What kind of programs do they want? And when you meet with each community, then you put it together, and that helps transition. They'll understand immediately that I'm the person you can walk up to and say, I don't like this. And I'm not going to say, well, go see the area superintendent. I said, well, tell me what you want, and then we'll talk about it. And if it's something significant, obviously, I have to come to you. But at the end of the day, these meetings will show that I'm here to listen, and that goes back to listening. I'm going to listen to you. I'm not going to wait for you to stop talking. And that's key. And then we bring it back. Then we bring it back, and the cabinet would sit down, and we would beat it up a little bit and say, why aren't we doing this? How can we do this? Nobody likes this. Why are we still doing it? Is it effective? Does it mean something we have to do by state? And then beat up each one of those categories of the parents from all the communities. I'm thinking somewhere from 7 to 10 to big county because you want to get every community. And then we beat it up from there. And then we make those adjustments. And then we let communicate out through our communications director. We've listened, and we're going to work on these things. I think a response, knowing that the people who we represent, all of us, will be very happy with that.
Great. Thank you. What methods of communicating with parents have you found most effective, and how would you encourage and leverage parental involvement?
So there are two different types of parental communications. Informational, which can go out in multitudes of ways, through Twitter, through Facebook. I think there's a Facebook account here, Twitter. These are general information. If it's talking about specifics of a school, it needs to be from that principal. If it's something that details, there was an issue on campus today. But if it's really important, it's got to be a phone call from me, if it's that big. It's got to be a phone call from the principal first. That is the only way to communicate to parents. They don't want to read it in an email. They don't want to hear about it through different sources. We are very clear that principals are the first line to talk to their parents. And once it gets, because principals usually resolve it, and parents try and circumvent sometimes. They're trying to get what they need for their child. But we've entrusted our principals to be in charge of their school, let them be in charge. And if it can't be resolved, then it goes through them. But it's got to be a parent phone call. We make phone calls, or we meet in person. We don't send emails, and we don't get into an email discussion over a lengthy issue.
Great. Thank you. And because we do have a little bit of more time remaining, how do you envision yourself being available in a proactive way to our stakeholders who we've talked about parents, we've talked about employees, but your relationship with the media and being able to stay in front of the dialogue rather than always being at a responsive nature to?
Unfortunately, sometimes or most of the time, we are in a reactive mode as a school district. We understand that. But there have been many times where the superintendent, previous superintendent, can you call so-and-so at the newspaper? You're the only one they listen to. You have a good relationship with them. I'm out in front of a lot of things, and I give them the heads up. But I always have asked them this. Please be respectful and give us an opportunity to explain the situation instead of hearing one side. And we will give you everything you want. Any type of public records, if you're not getting it within a week, call me. I'll make sure it's there. But the communications to the media is really it can be a slippery slope if you let it and you continually react to it. But if you're out front and transparent and honest and let them know what's going on, I think you garnish their respect and they understand they can call you and get the right answer from you. And that's been my success. If you speak with the reporters from the Palm Beach Post or the Sun Sentinel or any of the news stations, they will tell you that when they call me, I answer the phone. And I said, make sure, give me 24 hours to answer this before you run anything on that. And we've had a lot of success in that. And as a regional superintendent, I've thwarted several things already this year that in that matter. Communication to the business community and the main stakeholders is strong as well. Parents don't want to hear about something that happened on their student's campus through the news. I mean, that has to get out right away. And those, and I think you were referring to that as well, all stakeholders. And we do that through informational. That's that informational piece.
Great. So. Thank you. I'll yield the rest of my time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Colon. And we're moving on now. And next will be from school board member, Ms. Jamie Haynes.
Hello. My section is on human resources.
Okay.
So the first question is, in our system, the superintendent handles the operations of a variety of programs and duties due to the size of the system. Explain your specific experiences with exceptional student education, federal programs, and career tech.
Okay. I may have to come back to the other two, but let me start with exceptional student education. And I believe you're asking me my role as a leader with ESE. So I've alluded to a little bit earlier about offering opportunities. ESE is not a gray area for me. If a team of teachers and professionals deem that a child needs additional services, it's not gray. The IEP team determines that, and that's what we provide. And we do a careful and long, lengthy study to make sure it's accurate. And when that becomes law, and that becomes part of the child's record, we adhere to it. We adhere to it. I was a principal of some high-need students, 254, 255 for the funding people in the world, in the classroom, or in the boardroom. They needed services all the time. And being an advocate for the student is an immediate impression for my teachers, and at the high school as well, that I was going to support what the child needs. We're not here to try and deny services. We're not here to try and distinguish what services they should get. It was clear what they should get. The professionals decide, and we're going to support it. I think you'll find a huge ESE following from me because I've defended many parents in IEP meetings that turn the other way and simply said, no, we need to provide this. I see this child every day, and they're not doing well. More services. Services come at a cost, and that's key. So as you look at certain budgets, including the one that I think you led for a few years here in the district, we have to make sure we're providing more services. And I think I'll get into that if I have the opportunity later, that we have to provide services and reduce positions that are not really on the books. There's got to be a position control. There has to be a way to designate, is this position valued? Because as you look at one of the schools I visited this morning, Palm Terrace, and Mr. Harris, I felt like I saw myself from 15 years ago. That's the way to do it. I walked into several inclusion classes because I asked them, let me see the inclusion classes. And they not only had the teacher, but they had the paraprofessional in there and another paraprofessional. And you can use that with Title I monies or monies as you look through the financial piece. But the reality is when you have those resources in there, when you have additional people in there to be attentive to those included students, not secluded. I'm not a fan of pull-out. I never was, never will be. Included. Then you see the change. And just look at his scores, 45-point gain last year, not getting the recognition, even though they are under LSI. That man is doing a phenomenal job, and I do not expect to see that school as a D or a C. I'm thinking B or A, because that school is just tearing it up, and he's got it going on there with systems and processes. So I really was impressed with him. I was impressed with my other middle school, but that really hit me hard when I was able to go see those ESE courses with that inclusion and just dynamic teaching and assistance.
So the other two areas under that are federal programs and career tech.
Well, the federal programs, I think I tied a little bit into there. Remember, we have to be careful about our students who don't get the opportunities at home. We've got to make sure we're providing it before school if we can and after school. And I think there was a recent time change for the bell schedule. So I know that we're looking, at Volusia County, we are looking at making sure we're providing services early in the morning school. Those resources are important, and they're there for a reason, and they're provided from by the government to us to provide for those students who need those additional services, and it needs to stay that way. And it has to be true educational practice going on in these. It's not daycare. It's not recess time. And recess time is important. But it has to be an academically focused with the folks that are running it, understanding where the weaknesses are with the students. And I think the last area was?
Career tech.
I know a little bit about career tech. It's my favorite. Career tech, and I think I alluded to it in several different questions, we need to offer as many opportunities as we can to all our students. Gone are the days of people feeling they have to go to college. It's preparing them for college, and it's preparing for career. That's not our choice to give them. It's our choice to make sure they have it. They make the choice on where they go. I was unable to go to college right away, even though I had basketball scholarships and academic scholarships because my father became very ill, who was a teacher for 30 years. If I didn't have any of those skills I got from my high school in a construction academy, I wouldn't have been able to provide for my family and help them and be able to pay the bills and the mortgages. I did later go back to college, as you can see. But I remember that. And my brothers are still in the contracting industry, and I was with them. And if I didn't have that skill, and we were poor, and my father wasn't working at the time, Mom was sick as well, I didn't have those skills. I wasn't able to, and my brothers, we weren't able to provide for our, pay those mortgages. So every kid deserves that. I don't care where you are on the spectrum. CTE is the way of the future, and I know some people still call it vocational. I'm okay with that. But college and career ready, give them the skills. Give our kids the skills and let them make the decision. Because college isn't getting cheaper, last I checked. I have 4 children. I understand that point. Did I answer that?
Yes.
Okay.
From a district perspective, explain how student performance standards impact planning and prioritizing of facilities, fiscal, technological, and human resource projects.
Okay. I'll try and break that down into bits, and I may have to ask you to repeat those back ends for me. I'm going to go back to what I saw over at Palm Terrace. We talked about his facility and his ESE. So I looked at that and said, this is the ideal situation that we always try and get. Building looked beautiful. It was clean. It was presentable. Kids were in a clean, safe place, organized. That facility apparently needed some attention. When we're talking about schools that are at risk or on the state's watch list, our attention has to be there. Remember, we don't get there unless we're not doing something right. We get there and we stay away from there in that watch list by doing the right things and making sure all the schools have the right resources. But in a reactive mode, we better be able to double down, and that's what I call double down in the classrooms with the paraprofessional. We better be able to provide additional services in the morning and the afternoon and provide a clean environment, a safe environment. And with that piece in student achievement, now you have the ability to look at the specifics of what is not doing well. Learning Gains, obviously, is struggling in the district right now, and there's no excuse for Learning Gains to be that. And when you get to those paraprofessionals being in those and doubling down, they can address that individually with those kids, and it should be targeted. One of the things I would need to see is what are the midterm assessments? Where are they? So we can target these schools. I don't expect LSI to be here. I hope they're not by next year. But that'll be the last visitor that comes in to tell us how to run our schools. And no offense, because it's a great operation. It's a great organization. But we're going to run our schools, and we're going to make sure we're running them the right way. And that's putting a focus on where resources are needed. So I think I got that, but there's a couple more pieces to it.
So basically it's that student performance standards and the impact that planning, prioritizing facilities, your fiscal part.
Okay, so now we're looking at planning. Are you speaking specifically of planning for the schools or teacher planning?
Planning for using your resources to raise student achievement.
We have a report card for each school, and as we look through with the academic team as well as the business side, the cabinet, we have to look at each school and their needs. And planning starts with those schools. Just like we started planning with the schedule for the students at risk coming from eighth grade to high school, that's where we start planning with our fiscal resources. It's not to take away from schools that have a lot more. It's to make sure that the schools that don't have. We live, we work, and we play in the same arena, but the arena looks different in different areas. And it's our job to make sure we equalize that and putting our resources in the right place to see that our arena looks the same everywhere and everyone has the equitable opportunity. And that's where you start with your planning, right there. What schools need it the most first.
So moving on, to what degree do you believe responsibilities can and should be delegated to principals? And how would you hold them accountable for accomplishing those responsibilities?
Should I step in and become your superintendent, I'd be honored, first of all. But most importantly, we've entrusted the people who lead our schools right now to lead them. And we have to give them that, continue that operation by supporting them. Principals are given that autonomy to run their schools and run it to the best of their ability. Should there be some problems, then it's our job as the district support, as the superintendent, to provide the supports in the area that they are not able to run their schools. And sometimes it may not be in their control. There's something that I would bring in to the district, and it's called the Principal's Dashboard. I have a copy here. I'll show you all tomorrow. And it has every column of every needed data statistic for the entire school. Absentee days, suspension days, how many teacher vacancies, Title I students, right down the line, everything, you name it. And then it also has their data on their performance. That is updated daily. Remember what I said before, when a child is suspended twice and misses a lot of school and are in property, the likelihood of them succeeding is almost nil. Principals need to see that, and they need to see it every day. So it's pulled up on my dashboard every day, and you'll see that the data sells, and it's updated through the current systems, and you'll see that it is a common place to walk into the principal's office and say, your suspension rates are going up, and they're level one or two suspensions, which means they're tardies or too many missing a Saturday school. It's not a significant event. Why are you sending this child home? We want to keep our campus safe, but five tardies is not a worthy reason to send a child home, and that shows up on this dashboard. So I'm not a big fan of suspension. I understand it's peace in the world, but I believe that we put the proper systems in place, put the right people in place where students have a place to go to. I think we'll see a significant drop in those. SEL is big now, is a big fan of.
How would you address the issues of safety and security?
As an educator and going to school to learn how to be an educator at one point, I don't remember the class on school safety. I don't remember the class about weapons in schools. I remember learning how to teach and reach out to children. Unfortunately, that has become a significant piece of what we do every day, and the state has made it very clear that we are going to focus on it. I mentioned earlier I'm 6.5 miles from Stoneman Douglas, and it affected many of the communities, and we had some of the students spill over into our district, and that was okay. Right beginning of last year, and I'm going to give you an example of how I do it. Beginning of last year, we had a shooting at one of our football games at night by adults from the street into a crowd of about 5,000 people. You want to talk about crisis communication? You want to talk about how do you get it to the board and how you get it to the news and make sure everything is right? The next day, superintendent asked me to go ahead and put out a safety plan for all activities after school and have it done by the end of the week. I worked with our school police. We came up, and within 2 weeks, we had magnetic signs all over. We had published it through the newspaper. We had published it through the news. That no one was allowed to bring anything in. You were not allowed to come in after halftime. You were going to go through metal detectors and handheld devices for everyone that walked through. It was setting the table to say, when you come, we cancel football for the next week. And then the second week went off without an absolute hitch. We actually had business donors call and say, we will donate clear bags for women that want to bring their purses in or their items in. It was a community effort because we reached out and said, this can't happen to our community. It happened next door, and you can't go back. So within 2 weeks, I had a clear safety plan for the entire district on every event. And when you talk about 23 high schools, 34 middle schools, and get it done in 2 weeks, We did a great job. And I believe there's a county somewhere near here, maybe even here, that stole that entire plan, which was perfect because Miami-Dade stole it and so did Broward because it was so set in a way of maintaining safety. One of the things that we have to do as well is make sure that we understand Fortify Florida is out there and it's starting to get cleaned up a little bit. I mean, I get the 30 messages a day. But we also have to know that students have a way to go to somebody. And there's that relationship piece. They have to have a campus where they know they can go to an adult. I saw that on two campuses today, and I was very comfortable with what I saw. One had a Daytona Beach police officer, which was wonderful because I believe that's the agreement there. Another had a security or a guardian, which was wonderful. And the principal was bragging about the guardian because he became a member of the school, became a part of the school, and students didn't see this as a threatening person. It was someone they could go to. And that is about the communication piece. So I think I talked to you about safety. Safety is huge. And the police chief who just came on, he said, why are you doing this? You're assistant superintendent of choice and innovation. Why are you doing safety? Because I was asked and because I know all the facilities and my broad experience in being in regional and area and alternative ed and charter schools and seeing all that, that I would have a perspective of everything there. And with a lot of cooperation from a lot of people in that district, we came together because we knew what could happen, and we don't want that anymore.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Haynes, too. And now we'll have questions from our vice chair, Ms. Ida Wright.
Thank you. Good afternoon again.
Good afternoon.
Fiscal management. Our funding budget concerns are paramount to the continued success of the district. Please describe the process you have used when budget cuts have been necessary, and please expand on your position related to budget reserved dollars.
Okay, that's a two-part question, and I'll try and tie them together, but I think I can. So to start with the first part about a budget cut process, about 5-6 years ago, all the divisions were asked to reduce 5%. And I know that in this district, you guys have been really hard on the DCD. You're working through it. It's cost you, I think, roughly $10 million a year for 16 years. And I think if you look at your deficit and what you've tapped into, you wouldn't have to tap into anything. Actually, it'd be a surplus. Unfortunately, I'm coming from a district that actually benefits from that. But it's unfair saying that you guys do not. And I know that a push to at least keep everyone at 1 is always a good thing. Keep everyone at least 1.0. That's a fair shake. But when you talked about budget cuts, I knew I had to reduce 5% in my divisions, and especially in the choice area, where we give $15 million to about 42 schools that we've been giving for the last, 15 years. And that was going to be easy because some schools were getting near $900,000 to $1 million, and some schools were only getting $200,000. And this was to keep their choice programs. And this is when we only had about 150 choice programs. We've doubled that since. So by reducing some of the monies that went to the schools that were now sustainable, they had been sustainable, and they were really had additional or surplus abilities to provide more education, we realized that we could cut back there. So I got together a group of principals, sat with the director and the specialists, and we talked about where we could cut. Not only did we cut 5% without real pushback, because the schools knew they were already getting money, surplus money, we increased the cut to 10% and took the additional 5% and opened new programs in schools that weren't getting money, that had students that needed to see some programs, like new arts programs, like technology programs, like construction academies, health informatics in one of our schools, and I know that's near and dear to someone's heart here. We were the only middle school. I was able to open up a middle school health informatics academy that was the only one in the country at that time. And you know how important that is. And they fed right into a school that was a medical school, biotech school, or a technology school, a business school. So we were able to expand programs, cut the budget, not 5%, but we did 10%, and there was a little pushback. But when you showed on paper what it meant, everyone was in agreement this was for the greater good, and it only affected about 10 schools, some maybe a unit, some maybe supply money. But it was involved, not everyone agreed with it but understood it. So I came to consensus, and I had the principals involved and well. So that was one of my big wins when you cut the budget, and that's my normal process. Get the people involved, the stakeholders, and sometimes that means when you're cutting budgets, you have to get outside agencies as well to represent what's best for the communities. But you always have to have the principal buy-in, too. They're important. They're our school leaders. They're the ones that need to understand. And they're on the, you know, they're on the front line with teachers, so we have to make sure we listen to them and get their input. So the other half of that question would be, I'm sorry.
That's okay. And expand on your position related to budget reserve dollars.
Budget reserve dollars are supposed to be reserve dollars. They should be the last resort, and you can only tap into budget reserve dollars only so many times. In order to maintain a high credit rating for the district, you can't go below a certain percentage. And I know this district is about 2 points away from that, which is pretty safe and comfortable. But really comfortable is about 7 or 8% with budget reserve dollars. Right now, I think you're just over 5. You can't get into keeping that credit rating is vital. I believe that an audit of many different departments and seeing what is being spent and where it's being spent, position control, and reducing the outflow of money that we don't have, that we have to tap into reserve, is the best way to do this. So that's one of the things I would like to implement with your assistance and your guidance on how to go about looking carefully at every position in the district and how it relates to student achievement. Understand that student achievement is our focus, but there are ancillary pieces that make student achievement possible. Kids aren't learning if they're not on a bus to school. They don't feel safe, and they're hungry. It's not happening. So we would have to really look at that position control piece and reduce that, because you can't keep spending more money than you have. And we can't lose that credit rating, because there are some implications in that I think we all know, and it's not a good place for a school district to be in that place. Did I answer that?
You answered my question. Okay. What is the largest budget you've been responsible for or had to oversee? And what was the greatest opportunities and challenges in that budget?
So you could go with the 60 schools that I oversee right now. That's not really fair, because the principals are the direct leader of their budget, and they're only working with about 4% of that budget, ins and outs. It used to be about 10% when I was a principal. Now it's only about 4. So I'm going to stay away from that, because that's 60 large schools, you know, 3 elementary schools that are over 1,200 students. Couple high schools, 3,000-4,000 students. That's the biggest budget. That's probably not the fair answer here, because I think you're looking to see other places. So as Assistant Superintendent of Choice and Innovation, we had the charter schools, we had the adult ed, the community ed, we had alternative education, we had all athletics, we had all the medical and all 187 nurses. We had all of choice and career options. We had homeschool and we had virtual school. So when you add up all that, I believe it was in excess of $50 million. Managing that is not hard when you have the right leaders in charge. Managing that when you don't have the right leaders, or you've been spending money in the same place with no accountability, was difficult. And we had two places like that. And we realized that we couldn't keep getting letters from the state about money and about attendance when it came to adult education. So we went through an audit with my new director, who was a high school principal. And within 2 years, and I'm expecting Palm Beach County will not get a letter from the state about budgeted items and attendance with adult ed. Remember, we have over 50 adult ed sites down there, adult and community ed. That's a city. We have over 20,000 students that come to school at night, mostly parents, and we have a bunch running during the day with our elementary schools. And that was one of the areas we put money into. We opened up a bunch of satellites in elementary schools where the parents would drop their children off and take ESOL and GED courses alongside their children in another wing. So when they came home, they could discuss about language and learning and reading. Remember, if we educate the parents, half the battle is done, because many of these students' parents don't speak English. So that was one of the ways we were able to look at a budget that wasn't being done quite well and now in perfect shape, as well as redirecting and reallocating for benefits.
How would you approach the budget process to ensure success during financially challenging times?
There has to be three sets of things in front of you on this. The first being student achievement. Our main job is student achievement. It's student achievement. What goes into that is a bunch of different things. Again, bus drivers and cafeteria and maintenance. But it's student achievement. is the number one priority. The other piece is your leadership. Everyone here who leads a division should be capable of understanding where their weaknesses are when it comes to budget and where their strengths are, and should be able to report that immediately. So there's student achievement data, your cabinet, and then you have to have, of course, outside entities, business, colleges, mom and dads, grandparents, that sit on an audit committee that we process things through. And we do not bring anything to you to approve until all three of those things have been met. And when those three are in harmony, and you have everyone agreeing that student achievement is number one, that the departments could be thinner or need more. Sometimes they need more. We have to look at other places. And that the community input and the audit, business, accountants, those people that rely on us to produce the future talent is in agreement. Then we sit down and realize this is what we do. And then it is brought to you. It is not brought to you with hope. It is brought to you with concrete data, approval, consensus, and as a one-person plan, the person being the entire district, not just Pete Licata. It has to be in harmony, and that's the plan we stick with.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Okay, my turn.
Okay.
Would you elaborate just a little bit more? You were a high school principal. Is that right?
Best job in the world. The hardest job in the world.
Best job. Being a principal is the best job. So what makes an effective school?
An effective school is many components. And I saw one this morning. I saw two, actually. I can't say the middle school was phenomenal. The first thing I look for when I walk on a campus is a child's face. I know that's so elementary, but when you see them smile, when you see them run to the principal, you see that they're happy. You see that it's a good place. But that doesn't mean learning's taking place. It doesn't mean the staff is happy. It just means kids feel happy. But then when you see the staff walk down the street or hallway and make sure they introduce themselves and talk about, and this happened, I have planning next period, I need to get to this, this, and this. Can you step in? Those are the things. So that's just across the top answer, but underneath, it's systems and processes, structures, and relationships. Everyone has to know the goal. They have to know the plan to get there, and that's the process. And the relationship of knowing that there are going to be applied pressure for accountability, but they're also going to have support. We can pressure teachers all we want and tell them they need to do better, do better, do better. But if we don't analyze their professional development and where we're not supporting them, then it's a failure on us. And for us to look at a teacher and say, you're not doing a great job, that blame is on us if we're not supporting them. I'm not sure about Volusia County. Well, I am pretty sure about Volusia County. There aren't teachers out there. When I applied to be a teacher, I was the 10th person on the list when there was a glut of teachers. It doesn't exist there. We're not going to go find new teachers. If a teacher is harming a child or not being, you know, has done everything we can, I get it. But I think the strength of being a leader is making sure teachers are better and are prepared and giving them the environment to be best they can be. Just be the best they can be. And when I see a teacher failing as a principal, I felt it was my fault. And if you look over the history, they actually called one of the universities in the area called and said, as a principal, you have a very low attrition rate for teachers. How is that? What are you doing? I couldn't answer the question because he was asking me who I was, really, and I was able to answer it. I don't know if they ever used the data, but my teachers knew that if they were struggling, they'd be supported and that I wouldn't let them fail. So I think I answered that question. When teachers who make the difference, Pete Licata as a principal didn't make a difference in the classroom. He made it for the whole campus. But that teacher sitting in front of those students was the one who was making the difference. We better support them and give them every tool possible.
Thank you. What do you feel is the single most important piece of data that would drive Volusia County forward?
You're 58 points away from being an A district. If you want to calculate that over the 11 categories for grading, that's what, 5.5, I think, close. single piece is difficult to determine. Learning gains was one that you can make significant improvement in. College and career ready was a lot lower than a lot of folks. I know that the students with disabilities could be improved, especially in the lower 25. There are several. So to look at one key piece of data, I don't know if I could give you that answer, and I don't know if that hurts me in my answer by saying that. But when you look at the 11 components that the state is asking, and the state isn't this all-knowing body that knows everything about education, but it's what we have to maintain and what we have to do. And when you look across those 11 cells, we need 58 points. It may not happen in a year, but it probably could, especially if you look at moving that graduation rate. There's a 10-point giveaway right there. When we're at 78% as a graduation rate, all right, that's a lot of kids. Out of 100 kids, we only have 78 graduating. That's one kid not graduating is a failure. But let's get that. That's a quick get right there. And by paying attention to those students right away, that's it. Your learning gains are another one. Let's get those resources that Ms. Haynes asked about. Let's get those resources in the paraprofessionals. Let's get them in the classrooms and double down in those classrooms. Make sure we're addressing the needs of the child, not addressing the needs of the class. Addressing the needs of the child, addressing the needs of class. And those data cells will start showing up. This should be an A district. And I'm no Joe Namath predicting a Super Bowl victory. As a Dolphin fan, I don't predict much anymore anyway. Maybe a loss. But I can tell you, I could make this an A district with you guys and the team and my relationships and building that capacity and focusing on what's even more important. I don't want to be in a place where I'm saying that there's things going on here that shouldn't and it's a bad. This is a great place. This is a great place for opportunity. I want something to be very, very clear. This isn't a stepping stone for Pete Licata. This is Pete Licata's capstone. This is Pete Licata's capstone. It's not a stepping stone. This is the place that when I drove over the bridge and I gripped that steering wheel a little harder, and a person over here that knows me better than anybody knew something was up. So this is my capstone, not a stepping stone.
Let me ask you, we kind of touched on it when you were talking about the single piece of data and what's important. And one of the things that we're concerned about is the reading levels, the lowest quartile mm-hmm. of our students mm-hmm. at each level,
right.
Elementary, middle, mm-hmm. and high school. What thoughts do you have on that? What successes, what programs do you think we
need? So I was hoping that question came up, so here it goes. Lowest 25 usually is the focus of every school district, and it should be. And if you were to ask me one cell, if you told me I had to give you one cell, that's it. Because those kids are most likely not to graduate. So as we put the resources in, and not just in inclusion classes, in those lowest 25 and in those intensive reading classes at every level, where we focus on which teachers are teaching at the secondary level, remember, we always put our best generals in the toughest fights. We need to start putting our best teachers in the toughest places. And the state doesn't reward us for that. The state rewards AP teachers and IB teachers and industry certification teachers because they get money when they graduate or when they pass the test through extra FTE and such. We have to start looking at how we can do something and be innovative in that area. Not out of the box, but forward thinking. Because those teachers are the most valuable because they're changing lives, just like every teacher, but they're changing lives that aren't supposed to be changed and are predicted not to succeed. So not only would you double down and put those resources into those classrooms, you'd have to do a quick look. And I saw it today. When I walk into a classroom, the first thing I look for, and when they're doing their rotations for a reading class or third grade, you have your small group, you have your teacher talk, and then you have your independent. What we're finding is there's no accountability in the independent piece. We're finding that the kids are reading, kids are on task, but no one is checking up on what they're reading and have they understood and comprehended. Their fluencies are great, but the comprehension isn't there. Or do we know it's there? How do we know it's there if we're not asking that question? So we'd have to really look at the model of instruction in every class and the system that's there. But the model of instruction has to be accountable to every student by the teacher. And then the principal has to make that teacher accountable to making sure that's what's happening. Screen time, online learning, platforms, and I'm sure they are there. The other thing I'd like to talk about, and it probably goes back to Ms. Haynes' question, we have to be very careful about what we purchase for reading programs or math programs online, virtual. I'm sure there's a great many vendors who have great products, but a technology department can't keep up with the amount of schools that want to do different things. And that would be one of the big changes on how we move forward. We can't just start implementing, hey, this works for my school. Well, show me it works for your school. Why? Prove it to me. Where's the data? You're a struggling C school, almost a D school. Why do you still want a program that you've been using for 3 years? It's causing us fits, and it's not effective. I think we need to give autonomy to our principals in areas we can. But when we're talking about putting technology in classrooms with certain programs, reading and math, and on virtual platforms for kids, we got to be a little more specific, because technology departments are very hard to staff and man right now, because the technology world pays a lot better. But more importantly, we don't have the manpower to keep fixing computers or running out and fixing access points or loading programs. So I'm not sure if you have a technology program, technology committee that all technology has to come through before it's put into a school, but that needs to be one of the focuses, because we can't keep buying things and keep trying to service every program that comes down the street that someone wants to buy. Let's stick with a couple things that work. Prove to me with data that this is valuable in your system and why you've maintained your A. Because if you're a C, struggling C school, and you want to buy something that you think works and hasn't been working for years, we're not buying it. And that's got to be a hard stop right there. And that's where superintendent makes a decision with input.
Thank you. Well, let me ask you this. What do you think your goals would be? What do you see yourself doing? Say you got this job. What would you be doing in the month of January? What would you say you'd want to be doing by the month of March, April, and then June?
You obviously were given the easy questions to answer, weren't you? That's sitting right here, and I've gone over it multiple times, and I use 100. Some people use 90. I like to use 100 because three numbers sound better than two. But for the most part, you need more time than 90 days to make an impact. But for the first 30 days, and this would be an accountable through a spreadsheet, and every bullet point I have in here, as a draft, I need your input and I need your focus on it too, if I was superintendent, to say, no, you're not doing this. Yes, you're doing this. And look at it and say, I have to meet with you first and understand our communication. What do you expect of me, and how are we going to communicate to make sure we act as one board? Because nothing comes good of internal dissension when we aren't all on the same page. We're not going to agree on everything, but as a group, we have to come to consensus. Then we go to the community. We go to the community and talk, and I think I talked about that with Mr. Colon's question, and we hear from them. We hear from them, and they're going to say a lot of great things. And they're going to say some things that they want individually, but when you hear enough individual statements of the same, then we got to look at it. Then we come back to cabinet. We talk to cabinet and say, here's my protocols, here's my system, here's what the board expects, and we're going to follow through with this. And get that detailed process and system very, very clean. And it's a team. And when we walk out of that room, that's the decision we're making as a team, because it's going to meet that. Once we develop that, we move through the teacher unions and the staff unions and the mechanics union. We have to talk to them. Those are vital people. Those are important people. That's in the first 30 days. Still visiting every school. 87 schools in 100 days. That's probably why I put the 100. That would be important, to be at every school. That's not undoable. It's a big county. I'm used to a big county. I need to be in every school. And I need for everyone to see that I'm actively engaged and involved in every single school. After 90 days and doing an audit of every department, textbooks, I know that's been a big topic, online learning, anything that needs to come through, safety, with all those, through that 90 days, and it's very detailed here, 100 days, I go from a transitional leader to a transformational leader. I now have all the data that we need, that we can go through and start a new process for a strategic plan. We can't just put together a strategic plan that is good for a few of us. The strategic plan has to be put together with all of us. And the strategic plan has to be based on everybody's input. Strategic plan here was developed and approved, I think, in January 2016, and it was a three-year plan, which means it's sunset about a year ago, roughly, right? Maybe half a year ago, and it's time. And I think maybe waiting for a new superintendent is really good. But when we put that strategic plan together, after everyone has their input, it's not Pete Licata's, it's the school districts, it's parents. We put it together and bring it to you. I think a show of support and unity would be for Mr. Persis, you and I, to present that plan, to show the community that we are on the same page, and every decision moving forward will be predicated on that strategic plan, and it needs to be in alignment. And when we buy something and we spend money on something, it's because it matches the strategic plan. When we cut something, it's because it's not in alignment with the strategic plan. So that strategic plan has to have at least four or five pillars on it that show everything from student learning to employee health and wellness. Mm-hmm. That's huge right now.
Yeah.
And we can't forget that. So all that's got to be included. And we can't just do it here in this room. We have to do it out there. And once we put that strategic plan together, our principles and our answers, principles L-E, not the person, our principles have to be predicated on that strategic plan that we all decided on as a community, as a school district, and move through that process. And it's a great reference point because when you have those tough decisions, well, we always did it this way. We always got this. It doesn't align with our goals. It doesn't align with our plan. Mm-hmm. And it's not me making that decision. It was all of us making that decision. And that's how you avoid a lot of bad communication. Mm-hmm. It's not Pete Licata. It's not Carl. It's not any of us.
Yeah.
It's that entire strategic plan that made that decision that we got together.
Okay. Thank you. Board members, we have a little bit of time. So if you'd like to ask another question, would anybody like to ask another question? Ms. Cuthbert? Yeah.
Do you mind if I curtail a question on something you commented on with Mr. Persis?
Please.
You said that we had to be careful with our reading programs that we have in our classes and our instructional programs, mm-hmm. that they must be working positively mm-hmm. to raise student achievement in order to reinvest time and money into them. Who do you give the autonomy to? Because a teacher who might have been used to using reading 180
mm-hmm.
has said, I have had to her principal, I have had success
mm-hmm.
with a different program. Can I possibly, you know, do this other program where I have achieved success with my students, especially a special education teacher?
Correct.
Would you agree to allow that teacher to do that, even though the principal may say, no, everyone in my school is doing reading 180?
I think this is a perfect question that goes back to what we just talked about, that strategic plan. Is it in alignment with what we decided, and is the achievement there? As a principal, I know that when I have a teacher who's knocking it out of the park, my best quality was getting out of her or his way and let them continue doing with them what they're doing. And when you have data that supports that, we have to listen to that. I saw a classroom this morning where there was a great sectional learning, and there was an online learning platform going on, and that school went up, what, 54 points? To me, that's working. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I'm very familiar with Read 180. It was in all my middle schools when I was director of curriculum. And if it's maintained with fidelity, it's very successful with training of the teachers and such. I don't mean we're going to come in and start taking things out if they're working. That would be counterintuitive. But let's make sure we're not adding things on that we don't know if they work and if we already have something available to us. We don't have the money to throw around to buy and have the flavor of the day. So I think your questioning is, would I overrule the principal on that? I think we'd have to communicate quite well to see why would you want to not have that constant program working when it's successful. Now, is it successful in her class and not in other classrooms? Now we have a different issue. It's not so much the program, it's what's going on with the other classrooms. And is there fidelity? So as we dive deeper into it, we find out really what the problem might be.
Thank you.
Good question there.
That was
a good question.
I don't like these corners. These corners are hard questions.
Mr. Colon, you have a question?
Yeah. Yield my time to
someone. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry. I thought you were asking. Oh. And Ms. Haynes, you have a question? Ms. Wright? Ethan? Anybody? No? Okay. Then let me throw it back to you,
sure.
Dr. Licata. Do you have any closing comments that you would like to make?
I believe I'm honored to be here, first of all. And I think before I arrived here at this seat, you knew how I got here. You saw my history. You saw my success in closing the achievement gap. You saw my focus on every kid. Remember, lowering the ceiling doesn't raise the floor at any time. But I think after talking to me for a few minutes, an hour and half while that flew, you understand the why. You understand the why. And it goes back to that day coming home from basketball practice as a sophomore in high school and hearing those words about my father. I wasn't going to college. I had scholarships. I could have gone, but I had to go to work. And when he died, he was a teacher. And when he died, we had a funeral with about 3,000 people show up, and mostly teachers and principals and students. And it was interesting because I sat there, and it was sad that we've lost this this person that everyone looked up to in the community. And I saw people walk up to me one by one and talk about the impact he had on his life. And it was like I was talking to myself. So absolute honest truth, the next day I went down to University of Miami, gave away my share of my business to my brothers, and asked them if they would still include my academic scholarship, and enrolled in January, or actually in April, because I was too late. Enrolled in April and finished my degree on academic scholarship. They honored it and knew I wanted to be a teacher at that point. I knew I wanted to be an educator because the saying goes is he died and my mother wasn't allowed to work, typical family back then. And he died poor, but he died wealthier than anybody I've ever seen. So that's the why.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. Thank you for your dedication to students. I can tell you it comes from your heart, and we all appreciate the many years that you've put into helping others and inspiring others along the way. Want to make sure that you know about the reception this evening, and we're looking forward. We'll all be there too, and should be a fun night, a good night. And then tomorrow morning, of course, you're back here. And,
yes,
and we,
I think I am in the boardroom all day tomorrow.
Yes, we have a room for you, I believe.
I'll bring a jacket
tomorrow.
my ear, I think, just chipped off somewhere back here.
Yeah, I'm sure. I hope you have a window. Yeah. I don't know. But
that's fine.
Anyway.
I'm honored to be here. I know the other two finalists are strong. It seems like I know them. They're wonderful people. And I can't tell you thank you enough for allowing me to be in front of you and speak in front of you.
That's
and
great.
I appreciate the opportunity.
And you know that the board will be back in session on Tuesday, November the 12th, and we'll make our final decision at that time. So that's it for right now. So we'll adjourn this part of the meeting.
Thank you
we'll
very
reconvene
much.
Later. Good afternoon once again. We are continuing with our school board interviews this morning and this afternoon, just to bring everybody up to date of what we have accomplished so far today. We began at 10 a.m. interviewing Dr. Ronald Scott Fritz. Mr. Fritz's interview was followed at 1 p.m. We interviewed Dr. Peter Licata. Let me go back and mention Dr. Fritz is from Osceola School District. And Dr. Licata is from the Palm Beach County School District. Our next interview will be with Dr. David Moore from Miami-Dade County, and we'll be beginning that interview right now. So let's welcome Dr. Moore. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, everybody.
Good afternoon. I hope you've had a good day.
I've had a wonderful day. Saw some great things at some outstanding schools.
Good, good. A good night last night, I hope, as well.
And, absolutely. Got in a little late, but we had a good time.
Good, good. That's great. Well, we are certainly glad that you're here, and want to take an opportunity to introduce our members of the school board, beginning with school board member from District 3, Ms. Linda Cuthbert.
Hey, how are you?
Our school board member from District 5, Mr. Ruben Cologne. Our school board member from District 1, Ms. Jamie Haynes. Our school board member and vice chair from District 2, Ms. Ida Wright. Connie Spire is our agency clerk. And next to me is our chief financial officer, Ms. Deb Muller. My name is Carl Persis. I'm the chair, and I'm so happy that you're with us and that you've enjoyed your stay in Volusia County. Each of us will be asking you questions.
Okay.
We've allotted about 12 minutes per person. Certainly, you'll have time at the end, Dr. Moore, to give a closing comment and ask any questions of the board, too, that you may have. So unless you have any questions, we'll just go ahead and get started.
I have no questions. I'm happy to be here. Looking forward to asking or answering any questions you may have.
All righty, then. The first question that I have for you is to just get your thoughts, your opinion on what do you think is the most important part of being a superintendent and why?
Establishing expectation. And when I say expectation, I mean expectation that would be blanketed over the entire Volusia County. Expectation is the opportunity for me as a leader to establish a belief that as a result of our relationships, our interactions, our connections with students, absolutely all students can and well learn, providing an environment for them that allows them to identify their potential, but also as a result of our teaching, our learning, empowering them with the skills, the ability, the behaviors, they can spend a lifetime redefining and enhancing that potential. So when you look at expectation, it is an expectation for every member of the organization, established in belief, defined by clearly establishing accountability and support. And when you look at accountability and support, it's the opportunity to connect with the organization, to connect with the people in the organization and say, hey, if we're going to be best by kids, we need to connect to one another. We're going to do this complex work, but we're going to have transformational impact on the lives of these children. We need to work together. We need to learn together. We need to support each other as we uphold our behaviors to fulfill the expectation that we have to have a positive impact on the lives of children. When I say expectation and having it blanket the entire community, that's ensuring that I am communicating as your superintendent that the members, the families, people in our churches, in the community, in the grocery store, they have an expectation on us. They fully hold us accountable to ensure that when they give us their most precious possession, their children, that we provide them with a transformational education that ensures that they can continuously redefine and accelerate their achievements within their lives. Mm-hmm. That expectation is communicated to me through the community. We work together. We leverage that complex work. So it is an opportunity to establish relationships, communicate an expectation, mutually hold ourselves accountable to implementing the behaviors, developing the systems and structures in order to ensure Volusia County is a world-class educational system.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So as we select our new superintendent, you know this is a difficult task for us. We have three outstanding candidates. So sticking with the number three here, what are your top three strengths, abilities, and how do you see that connecting with the Volusia County School District?
So you're looking for just three, right? Okay, just three. I am a member of a leadership team that has produced unprecedented, unparalleled results. I am bringing to Volusia County the know-how. I'm bringing an opportunity to establish new systems and structures that pull people together in order to ensure we produce unparalleled, unprecedented results here in Volusia County. So experience on how to do things differently in order to achieve significantly different results that are better. I think I have the ability to identify talent. I think I have the ability not only to identify talent, but pull those teams or those individuals together, connect them to one another, and empower them to solve complex problems. Being a superintendent of a district this size means you need to have world-class principals, world-class teachers, and world-class staff. And we need to be able to ensure that we're constantly investing in them, because when they're in their schools and they're leading their teachers, they have the ability to make difficult decisions in order to be best by kids. And then third, probably most important, I'm a teacher. I am an educator at heart. I am the son of a principal. It is in my blood. It is what I do. I see this career as God's work. As your superintendent, I continually will invest in my own development. Just as a pastor would be entrenched in the word in order to feed his or her flock in that particular faith, as does a superintendent need to be in his own or her own development in the research in order to ensure, if we're going to move to a 21st century learning organization, I need to invest in myself and invest in myself in order to ensure we have systems and structures and we are on the cutting edge in order to ensure we provide that kind of learning environment.
Thank you. We are now going to go around and ask a few questions,
right.
And we will begin with Ms. Cuthbert. And Ms. Cuthbert, whenever you are ready.
I'm going to address curriculum and student achievement.
All right, my favorite topic. Let's go.
All right. Yes, mine too. what innovative ideas do you have for our school system to address graduation rates across all subpopulations?
So when you look at graduation rates, I think there's opportunities to improve the overall graduation rate. So currently 79, Miami's at 85. I think there's a number of systems and structures that initially need to be in place. Ensuring that we're accurately reporting that information to the state would be priority number one. Are we accurately capturing where our students are finishing or, in unfortunate situations, not finishing? Those are simple structures at school sites between the registrar, between the assistant principal, the principals, and in between schools and in between various counties, ensuring we have the systems and structures in place in order to accurately monitor graduation rates. In order to ensure we're maximizing and ensuring every student that walks into our high schools in ninth grade, they graduate four years later, we need to ensure that we have a student services team that is empowered, engaged, and understands everything that they need to do to monitor the progress of students as they move through their 4 years of high school. It is unacceptable to wait for a student to be in 11th grade and be 4 or 5 credits behind before we start talking to them about remediating or recapturing those credits. We need to be proactive. We need to ensure when students fall behind, we don't wait for the end of a grading period. We don't wait for the end of a school year. We are connecting with them. We have real relationships with them. We are advocating for them in order to ensure they don't get behind. When you look at students, the biggest barrier to that graduation, that diploma that our students are all working so hard for, is that FSA ELA, that reading test. Once again, there are opportunities to ensure that as students who are struggling to find mastery on that particular exam, that we're being innovative and maximizing opportunities for them to receive concordance scores. So we should be working through PSAT, SAT, linking those assessments to Khan Academy and making sure we're using resources to expand opportunities for students to graduate. There are students who in 11th and 12th grade who have not found mastery on the FSA, then we need to look for alternative motives. And in Miami, we're finding tremendous success in using Khan Academy in order to accelerate opportunities for students to grow. Those are some strategies in order to ensure that graduation rate is where it needs to be for students who are struggling. The answer to your question is core instruction. The answer to your question is starting in K through 12, providing them with core instruction that is aligned to the standards and every day of the week, twice on Sunday. Except we don't work on Sunday, but you get my point. And when students fall behind, when they're not mastering those standards, we have the ability to differentiate instruction to pull them back up to the standard. We need to have a high expectation about what we're doing around core instruction and ensuring that we have the best teachers who we're supporting and we're empowering to never have it become an issue. Need to be proactive and intentional. And then closing comment on graduation rate, the biggest dropout strategy, activities, athletics. Ensuring that we have robust programming to connect students to that high school experience. That culture needs to be strong, it needs to be tight, it needs to be a place where every child walks into that school, feels comfortable, feels accepted, feels loved, and knows As a result of me being in this environment, the pressures of the world fall off me. I can fully connect to what's taking in that classroom and go beyond graduation, go to college, and find success.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Then how would you assist teachers, students, and principals in handling too many distractions that are now occurring during the school day? Drills, special assemblies, events, fairs, testing, concerts, pulling out students for special help guest speakers. That any school day brings to this this program. So how can we then support the precious academic time and keep that growing instead of all these other obstacles that impede upon that time?
Absolutely. I think an impactful superintendent, a powerful superintendent, the superintendent that I intend to be, models the behaviors that he expects of his principals. We need to honor classroom time. I need to, from a district perspective, if we push out initiatives and programs, protect that time. I don't need to just say that we're going to honor and protect instructional time. I need to support principals. I need to support staff in a way that sets that expectation, that if we want our children to succeed in a 21st century learning environment, we need to protect that particular environment. By setting that expectation and modeling that behavior, we also expect principals to do the same. And when principals do not, or principals fall away from rigorous academic programming and supporting and developing teachers to be world-class educators, then there's a level of accountability that reminds them of our expectation. And when I say accountability, once again, it's accountability to holding ourselves accountable to be in the best interest of children. So nothing stands in the way of my actions and my behaviors to be best by children. We need to ensure principals live and die by that same mantra. In our buildings, we are going to protect instructional time. We are going to walk in classrooms, and this is a practice that I did when I was a principal, and this is a practice I did yesterday when I was visiting schools. It was a practice I did when I was visiting your schools today. I envisioned Madison Taylor Moore and Caitlin Nicole Moore, my two daughters, in that classroom. Now, that instruction isn't good enough for them, then it's not good enough for the children who are in that classroom. And then I need to respond, and I need to react. And principals know. Principals have the understanding. They assess the entire day, every day. Every minute of a school day for a principal is an opportunity to reflect, evaluate, and learn.
Thank you. Okay, as the lead learner of a large school district, the fourth largest in the country, I must add, how would you influence or create a culture of inclusion that fosters high expectations to close the achievement gap of all of our subgroups, such as students with disabilities, students of low socioeconomic status, and those of all races?
We have one goal in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and it's student achievement. We hold ourselves accountable at every level of the organization as it relates to that particular goal. We ensure that every member of the organization has the opportunity to walk in their purpose. When I say walk in their purpose, they clearly understand the role that they have, whether it is the assistant superintendent or working in the cafeteria, how that role supports students, allows them to find success, may not directly connect to in-classroom, but everyone clearly understands we have one singular goal. They walk in their purpose each and every single day, understanding how their role, their job, supports student achievement. To answer your question, to be more specific, setting expectation, setting purpose, but ultimately ensuring as an organization, if we're going to grow and we're going to meet the needs of all learners, we need to be intentional about investing in ourselves. We're educators. We need to ensure that we have world-class teachers, world-class administrators, which means we take time out of the day to invest in ourselves. This system is too large for any one superintendent to bring about long-term impactful change. But if that one person, that one superintendent, is determined to invest in every member of the organization to ensure that they have the highest skills that across the nation regarding their particular role, then ultimately expectation begins to increase. Conversation and dialogue continues to happen regarding how we are ensuring we're addressing the needs of all learners.
Thank you. What is your vision for student learning, especially online learning, CTE, and STEM, or STEAM?
We're a STEAM district. It is to ensure that we're maximizing those programs and resources and the dollars that are often connected to them in order to improve. So when you look at STEAM, there are opportunities for staffs to come together, evaluate the programming that is in place, and problem solve on how to enhance the STEAM initiative and the STEAM programming that's being available. It's an opportunity to bring staffs together to look at rubrics, to define how do we improve our environment, how do we begin to integrate content and curriculum in order to ensure we're preparing students for the 21st century learning. I think CTE is an opportunity for improvement. So as I do my research, I see we have 44 CTE programs. But when I look at acceleration for our high schools, of the 10 high schools, it's about 23 percentage points lower than Miami. Miami's at 76. So there's significant opportunities. We need to ensure that those CTE programs lead to industry certification. We need to ensure that our students are connecting in these programs because they are relevant to the work industry. Industry has a need, and as a district, to be best by our community and best by our students, we need to ensure that we're preparing them with certification that puts them above someone who doesn't obviously have that certification in order to enter the world of work if that's where they, that is their goal, or that's where they want to enter into that the work world. So it's maximizing resources, it's maximizing the program and the content associated with those particular initiatives in order to ensure we're maximizing outcomes.
Thanks. And my last question, sir, could you please tell us a time when you've worked with others or have used an out-of-the-box approach to assist our, any district to achieve academic success?
That is my job. So 4 years ago, superintendent approached me and asked me to evaluate the systems and structures associated with the Education Transformation Office, the District Turnaround Office. And at that time, there were 65 schools that were below a C, and that was unacceptable to us. So rather than evaluate the systems and structures of one office that was providing support to D&F schools, we re-envisioned and shifted our paradigm to ensure that we were not just having systems of support for D&F schools, but designing ourselves in a way in which we would never have D&F schools. So on a daily basis, as we have created a number of different powerful practices that go across all cabinet members, my responsibility is to connect these cabinet members to the decisions that they make and the impact that those decisions may have on our district's most fragile schools. So I work every day in order to pull individuals together, great individuals who do great work, and maximize their intelligence and maximize the resources that they're available in order to ensure Miami-Dade County Public Schools has no DRS.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cuthbert. And now we'll continue with questioning from Mr. Ruben Colon.
So I am going to be covering internal and external communication. How would you ensure that the school board is informed of important matters?
So research is clear. When you look at districts that are successful across the nation, a prerequisite for that successful district is an informed and engaged board. If we are to be the district that I want to lead, the district that you want to lead, we need to be connected. To speak directly to your question, it's a willingness for each of us to establish a relationship. I can talk through and talk through the systems and structures that need to be available to ensure that you're informed, but I think I need to begin with relationship. Opportunities for us to connect is people who are connected in the purpose and power of public education. A willingness for us to hold each other accountable. A willingness for you to sometimes support me and encourage me, and sometimes the opposite. This is complex, difficult work. Transforming a district, I know, is difficult, complex work. But I also know we've been able to accomplish in Miami because our superintendent and his board are connected in mindset, connected in belief, and ultimately work together to support one another to move the district forward. So systems and structures that need to be in place. I know currently we do workshops, then have the board meetings in the afternoon. I think we need to be 6 to 12 months out and looking at the items that will come to be approved. I want you as a board to have opportunity to hear information in regards to policy or programs that you're going to be asked to approve. I don't want you to hear it for the first time in the morning and then approve it in the afternoon. I want you to have opportunities to provide me feedback. I want you to have opportunities to go out to your constituents and receive their feedback. I'm very intentional in everything that I do, very proactive in everything that I do. So I will ensure we will use that time of workshop in order to forecast out and have discussions about items and policies that you're going to be asked to approve with enough time to ensure that we're all on the same page and connected when it actually goes to the school board meeting. You'll receive impact emails from me on a weekly basis. This is an opportunity for you to receive the information on a weekly basis that you can review, peruse when you have the time to keep you informed of things that you need to be informed of. Now, it won't be an email when something, a crisis happens. That'll be a phone call. But as we go through the flow and the operation of a school day, or a system over the course of the week, there are opportunities to keep you informed. During your CMEs, what I call CMEs, it's an opportunity for me to sit and engage with you, talk through the difficult decisions that we're going to have to make regarding human capital at schools or shifts in assignments or operational or programming or facility concerns that we need to make. And it's an opportunity for us to connect and be on the same page regarding where we need to be. An informed and engaged board ensures that we will, in fact, be a transformational district.
Great. Thank you. When a new superintendent is hired, you want to make sure that the transition is as smooth as possible for everyone. How would you help both the educational community and the community at large adjust to the new governing style that will come with a new superintendent?
So we're in the business of people. Education is a people's business. And as a new CEO comes into an organization, absolutely, people are going to be concerned. People are going to have questions regarding the work that they do. We are passionate as educators regarding this work. And there will be confusion. There will be questions. As the superintendent, it is my responsibility to address those concerns as quickly as possible. Pulling together staff, teachers, administrators, district folks, and having an opportunity to connect with them regarding this is the entry plan that I'm going to be implementing over the next 100 days. This is going to lead to the development of a strategic plan. Do I believe there's going to be organizational shifts? Absolutely. Do I believe organizational shifts are a requirement in order to design ourselves in a way where we can maximize the shortfall of dollars that is provided by the states to be best by children? Absolutely. But what I know, if we're going to be successful at this work and be successful at this work for a sustained period of time, we need to connect to one another and do this work together. And this isn't one person coming in and saying, here is the blueprint, do things this way. I'm coming in with a theory of action that has produced outstanding outcomes. But within that theory of action is developing and investing in the members or the individuals who stand in front of students and stand in front of teachers each and every single day. You want to build a world-class educational institution? Invest in the individuals who make up that organization. Empower them to define where we need to go as a district and hold them accountable for those particular outcomes.
Great. Thank you. What methods of communicating with parents have you found effective, and how would you encourage and leverage parental involvement?
Every parent's reality is different. if that parent is coming from a single-family home, coming from poverty. There are parents who live together, a mother and a father raising a child. There are grandparents who serve as parents. There are foster parents taking on the challenge of loving a child and raising them as their own. But I know, without doubt, without reservation, those parents send their children to us with the expectation of receiving a quality education. When you look at parental engagement, we need to understand the complexity of their realities, the truth of their reality. And we need to diversify how we allow parents to engage in their child's education, using multimedia, using technology, allowing parents, whether it be a development of our own district app, whether it be gradebook communication, whether it be push notifications, opportunities to engage and be involved in the development of their child, even if that parent is working two jobs, because that's their reality. And because they're doing that to be best by their children, we need to continue to diversify our ways in which that parent can invest in their child. Keeping them informed is an expectation. Keeping them connected requires us to think differently about how we're involving and engaging parents. I think we need to ensure that we have a parent development program. The best job that I've ever had is to be a father. Learning how to be a father is complex, hard work. And as a system, if we're going to grow together, we need to invest and provide opportunities to engage and inform parents to establish a relationship with their children that leads to success, not only in the classroom, but in the community.
Thank you. So we've spoken about educators and we've spoken about parents. How do you plan to communicate with the public on matters of school control, of concern?
Provide access. You will see me out and about and providing availability of myself constantly. I have learned from one of the nation's greatest superintendent, if you're going to enforce expectation, if you're going to have one singular goal for a district, which is student achievement, you need to provide access. You need to be completely informed regarding where the district is, how it is functioning, and how do the individuals who are sending their children to us each and every single day feel about the quality of education. And then receiving that information, whether it be in the community, whether it be at church, always available to have deep conversation and dialogue regarding the truth of our educational system, and then circling back, not defending, not justifying, but being intentional about evaluating that concern or that feeling, holding individuals accountable in order to ensure we're making proactive decisions to improve the quality of this public education system.
Great. One last question. How would you ensure that all staff is informed on important matters?
All staff informed in important matters. Once again, it goes back to this being a people organization. As a superintendent, this is a large district, and you need to ensure that the individuals who are charged to lead people are very open and transparent. So as a superintendent, as I was saying, I will be available. I will be accessible. I will be able to have open and honest conversations about the truth of our district and follow up accordingly. Superintendent has to set an example on how we're constantly evaluating and learning. Staying informed, if we're not informed, we're not learning. And as adults, if we're going to improve our practice, and our practice is teaching children, we need to constantly have the systems and structures in place to evaluate our actions, to connect to one another regarding implementation, fail forward, identify opportunities to improve in order to grow faster than any other district in the nation. So it needs to be intentional. Keeping informed, if we're not informed, we're not learning. If we're not learning, we're not growing. And we become a stagnant, stale district. That won't happen.
Thank you. I yield the rest of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Colon. And now we are continuing with questioning from Ms. Jamie Haynes.
I have the area of human resources. In our system, the superintendent handles the operations of a variety of programs and duties due to the size of the system. Explain your specific experiences with exceptional student education, federal programs, and career tech.
All right. So when I first moved to the district, initially I was a director having the opportunity to support 40 of our district's most fragile schools, building conditions in order to ensure those schools were finding success. About 18 months into that assignment, I was promoted to the assistant superintendent of the Division of Academic Support. For just under 2 years, I led the Exceptional Student Education Office in Miami-Dade County Public Schools, the fourth largest district in the nation. During that 2 years, it provided me the opportunity to reorganize, shift the structures and systems of the office in order to maximize performance and support. A strong focus on building capacity and awareness regarding instructional activities to meet the needs of all students. A strong push on ensuring that we're increasing opportunities for our exceptional education students to find success in the mainstream. One of the things that I'm most proud of the time that I was in charge of that office was the establishment and creation of an autism office. This was an office that didn't exist before, but seeing the rapid growth of autism and the lack of understanding in terms of the district, as well as parents in the community, this was the opportunity to identify a solution to a complex problem, ensuring that our administrators and our teachers had a clear understanding of how to address and provide support for our autism students, while at the same time providing advocacy and support for the parents of autism children. When it comes to CTE, CTE is a constant evaluation, maximizing Perkin dollars in order to grow the industry certification exams and preparing students. So we need to be intentional, as I was saying earlier, of evaluating those particular industries, ensuring as an organization, as a district, those core offerings are relevant to the field, the work world. And if they're not, sometimes we need to stop offering them. We need to be bold enough to say, this is something that doesn't meet industry needs. We need to shift or modify that particular practice. But in partnering and working with our external partners and our businesses across the county, they've defined this need. There is a new industry coming into town, and we need to ensure that we're providing work-ready students to go into that career if they so choose.
What about federal programs such as Title I?
I was going to say Title I. I was just pausing. I'm kidding. So Title I is how the Education Transformation Office was funded 3 years ago. So knowing the work that you used to do, I know you know that funding for Title I has changed significantly over the last 4 years. In that shifts, dollars funnel through to the schools, as they should. But that did limit our ability to set aside funds in order to ensure as a district that we're being equitable and ensuring students who need the most receive the most. We work with our principals in terms of the allocation of Title I dollars, conducting what we call a master schedule reviews, looking at all of the resources at the school, how are those resources being used, and ensuring that those resources are, in fact, being divided up in a way to maximize outcomes. We also conduct what we call impact reviews. This is the ongoing evaluation of how these dollars are being used in order to ensure we're seeing a continuous return on that particular investment. Title I funding for us has been an opportunity to provide additional resources to some of our district's most fragile schools. So if you went back and you looked at the federal index that was just released regarding total funding, per student funding, you'll see significant variance in our district's most fragile schools. We know how to serve marginalized students. It is a priority for us. And when you look at what we value and you look at what someone values by looking at where they spend their money, you will see Miami-Dade County Public Schools as being proactive and intentional of ensuring a one-size-fits-all doesn't exist. One size fits none. We use those dollars, we use those resources to differentiate instruction by resources and programming so they receive everything they're entitled to receive.
From a district perspective, explain how student performance standards impact planning and prioritizing of facilities, fiscal, technological, and human resources.
Let's start with human resources. As I said, this is a people business. There's a lot of talk and conversation about understanding and teaching the standards and being able to unpack the standards and the complexity of standards. And all that's true. But you have to know the standards and the complexity of the standards to inform how you teach children. We start with children. We design lessons with the knowledge we have regarding standards and then scaffold the lesson based on the needs of those particular children. Now, in review of the data, there are significant opportunities to stop teaching to the middle. We need to be able to scale up instruction. There are high schools, Spruce Creek, as an example. 76% of the students proficient, only 51% attaining learning gains. That means rigorous academic programming needs to be evaluated. Every students who are above the standard, just being proficient doesn't mean that we're fulfilling their potential. So it is being very, very aggressive and looking below the standard. Beneath the standard, it is differentiating instruction and using data to inform practice. Not using data to say what we need to teach again, but looking at data to evaluate how we taught and connecting to one another, problem solving together to improve instructional practice. When you look at technology, when you look at buildings, in order to be a 21st century learning organization that's meeting the needs of the 21st century learning, you're absolutely asking the right question. We need to evaluate the kinds of technology that we're exposing students to and how we're challenging them to use that technology to solve problems or to define problems. We need to look at spaces. At Deland High School today, that space in the media center is a validation that we're doing some outstanding work. It was beautiful. It was creative. Had a coffee in the media center. Very innovative space being used correctly. But we need to see more of that. We need to re-envision how we're using our media centers. We need to re-envision how we're using our classrooms. We need to re-envision bell schedules. There's a lot of work to be done in looking at the retrofitting of buildings to prepare students for the 21st century.
Thank you. To what degree do you believe responsibilities can and should be delegated to principals? And how would you hold them accountable for accomplishing those responsibilities?
So when you ask that question, I want to be clear. I'm in this game with principals. I am equally accountable to the outcomes principals have. Will I hold them accountable for their outcomes? Absolutely. But that's not going to be sitting here in the office and saying, here are the keys, here's your outcome that you're supposed to obtain. Good luck with that. It is organizing us as a district to ensure every member of this organization understands how they are in the game to improve student performance. So hold accountable is one thing. But I want to be equally invested in supporting them, establishing the balance between support and accountability. Now, I assure you, when I did my tours today, my behaviors were different than my behaviors in Miami when I visit schools. But I have the highest expectation and belief in what principals should be doing. It is one of the greatest jobs in the world. And with that being such a great job, there's a high level of accountability. Every principal should be able to stand at that door, speak to the teacher behind that door, the kinds of support that teacher is being provided, the quality of instruction, and what we're doing in order to improve that quality of instruction on a daily basis. And then we walk out, tell me your feedback. How are you going to support this teacher based on what you observe today? How are you going to continue to grow and invest in that teacher based on your observation today?
Next, how would you address the issues of safety and security?
Safety and security for us is an expectation. It is a daily walk. As I said earlier, learning can't happen unless students walk into schools and they feel as if the pressure of the world come off them, as if they're walking in a church. In this house, I know I am loved. I know I am cared for. I know I am respected. I can be who I am, and I can connect to what's being done in classrooms. It is a daily responsibility. In Miami-Dade County Public Schools, we are the one district in Florida that does not use the state's generic template for school improvement. It didn't meet our needs. It didn't meet our teachers' needs. It surely didn't meet our students' needs. So we developed our own. And in that process, we start with culture. We don't start with academic programs. Academic programs are important. But before we get to academic programs, we need to ensure that adult behavior is correct. We need to ensure that we're being intentional about creating environments in all schools in which we're developing a safe, warming, caring environment. So to be specific in addressing it, we hold schools accountable to investing in developing and planning for environments in which they feel safe, students feel safe, comfortable, cared for, and loved.
Quickly, how would you characterize your relationships with employee groups in your current position? How would the unions in your current and previous district positions describe you?
As someone who is an innovator, someone who has a high expectation, someone who will stand side by side with them and engage in this work, someone who knows and believes that there is no job in this district that is beneath him, someone who is open, honest, someone who will say, I made a mistake, and I need to rectify that, I need to apologize. Relationships is key to working with unions. Our goal is the same. We come at it maybe from different perspectives or different units of work, but ultimately, the opportunity for us to connect together and work together is absolutely based on relationships, saying something and then actually following through and doing it.
Thank you, Ms. Haynes. And we'll continue with questioning from our vice chair, Ms. Ida Wright.
Good afternoon again.
Afternoon.
Fiscal management. Tell us about the latest large critical budgetary decision you made. What was the decision? What was the situation? Who was involved in helping to resolve the process or resolve the issue? And what was the impact of your decision? So I'll start with, what was the situation?
All right. Are we going to break down the question? Or So as I said, I believe I'm extremely intentional and proactive. It is my goal as a leader and as a superintendent to identify situations that could be problems 6, 12, 18 months down the road. So the situation, in order to answer your question, revolves around instructional coaches. So my office, the Turnaround Office, Education Transformation Office, biggest investment is instructional coaches. And using those coaches as they intended to do, build, support, and develop teachers. We had a problem in securing quality coaches, those who really wanted to be in schools. We had a problem with administrators using those coaches as they were intended to be used to provide support. They were using them as, you know, administrative assistants and carrying radios and doing bus duty and things of that nature that were ultimately going to not remove away from investing in teachers. So we did two things. I reduced the external office by 19 employees, 19 curriculum support specialists who were at the district, sent them back to schools. I want the best closest to children, supporting teachers who stand in front of children every single day. use that reduction in the budget to negotiate with our union a incentive, a increase in pay, a stipend, so we could recruit and retain the right coaches. Coaches who are able to work under an MOU to protect them to do what both the union and I thought was important, build capacity, ensuring 80% of their time was in direct contact in support of instructional coaches. And then to put my money where my mouth is, for lack of a better way of saying it, at the end of the year, ask the teachers who received the support from that coach, did they provide support? Did they build your capacity? Or were they just seen as another administrator trying to move up on the career? And if that was the case in that agreement with the union, we wouldn't pursue that individual as a coach anymore. The outcome was once again significant improved increased achievement for the Education Transformation Office. That is the year we went from 32 D schools down to 16 and then to 5 and now just 1. So what initially was, we're reducing staff less to go into schools and provide responses to critical situations. Ultimately, what we did was invest in building capacity at school sites to sustain practices and outcomes over time.
Okay. And staying in line with that, this is somewhat of a follow-up, so I'm not going to read the entire question because I was going to ask about a time that you had to make budget cuts. So you used that as an example. But expound on, then, how do you feel about reserves? Budget reserves.
So in a review of Miami's reality and Volusia's reality, there is a healthy reserve in Volusia in comparison to Miami. And I think that's a good thing. I think there's solid fiscal management in place. I think there are opportunities to evaluate how we're spending our money. And as I said earlier, if you look at what someone defines as being important, all you need to do is look at where they're spending their money. So in a review of the total budget, I see there's about a 2.5% of the total budget spent in central staff in Volusia in comparison to Miami. So there are opportunities to evaluate how we're organized as a district to increase opportunities to pool funds closer to children. I look at instructional resources at schools, and there's about a 5% difference. We spend 5% of our budget more on instructional resources dollars at schools versus Volusia. So fiscally responsible, we're in a good place. But by establishing a strategic plan that's grounded on improving student outcomes, we then could have a values-based budget system that allows us to connect every dollar we spend to the advancement of our strategic plan.
What is the largest budget you've been responsible for, and what was the greatest opportunities as well as challenges in that budget?
So the Education Transformation Office supports, on average, between 78,000 to 84,000 students on a yearly basis. If you look at the entitlements that are connected to those schools as well as the FTE, that's over $1 billion. So what are the outcomes? The outcomes are unparalleled, unprecedented results. 5 years ago, 64 schools below a DNF. Today, just 1. Academic graduation rates for those schools have improved by 14 percentage points. Proficiency in reading has improved by 8 percentage points. 76% of the schools in Miami-Dade County Public Schools are either an A or a B, which is 13% above the state's average. So the outcomes of how we do this work and manage these dollars in order to maximize outcomes by investing in the members of the organization to ensure they're world-class has been significant.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. My turn.
All right.
All right. We talked a little bit, and you mentioned, I think, a couple of times, principal's the best job in the world.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. So what makes an effective school?
A clearly defined expectation, an unwavering belief that as a result of our interactions and our relationships with children, that they can walk into our classrooms and not only feel safe and feel comfortable, but we can provide them with the thinking, the power, the knowledge, the instructional activities to continuously redefine that expectation. An effective school is an empowered school, that the members of the organization or the school clearly are valued, they're respected, we're maximizing the levels of thinking. Teachers feel safe, they feel comfortable, they can take a risk. They can tell their principal, I really think this is an outstanding idea. And the principal will say, you know what, let's explore it together. It is a school that accelerates adult learning. If you want to maximize outcomes, you do that by empowering schools to excel, the adults in schools, to accelerate their learning, ensuring that they're connected in a way to constantly evaluate instruction. And when I say evaluate, I'm talking about the administrator conducting their evaluation for the end of year evaluation, but reflecting on implementation, being provided support on implementation, problem solving with one another on how to possibly improve that. Successful schools are schools that have adults who constantly learn. Impactful schools do that learning quicker than others.
And so how do you evaluate that effectiveness?
A number of ways. First way is not to do it from the central office. It's to do it in schools. So I live and will continue to live in schools, evaluating the systems and structures, asking the right questions to the principal, the assistant principal, the cafeteria worker, the students, regarding how they are perceived, how they are valued, where are we going? Being very intentional. I do not walk into any of the schools that I support without their school improvement process in my hand. In our district, as I was saying, we have our own school improvement process. School sites, the leadership teams working with their teachers have defined these are our essential practices. These are the things that we evaluate in school culture, sorry, and academic programs to be the most important to improve outcomes for children. These are the action steps that we're taking over the course of this particular 9 weeks. I'm going to walk in that school and say, show me the implementation of this particular plan. So I walk in to schools informed, knowing what the school sites have defined as their priorities. And then problem solve with principals regarding the implementation that I see. So I evaluate it on a daily basis.
Okay. What do you feel is the single, I know this is hard, what is the single most important piece of data that you think will drive the Volusia County School District forward?
Ownership. And when I say ownership, it is the complete dismissal of blame. It is individuals at every point of the organization who love what they work. They love where they work. They love the work that they do. They own the work that they do. And when I say ownership, when you own something, you invest in that. You want to keep it nice. You want to keep it pretty and in a good place. When people just look at education as a job or something that they have to do, there's no ownership. So when I say assessing ownership, that's a hard thing to assess. But when you live and breathe in schools, you have a clear understanding of the perception teachers have and whether are they valued, are they not valued. When you live and breathe and connect to the community, mm-hmm. does that community own and want to support that particular school in which their son or daughter goes to? Or are they just completely frustrated with how they're treated and then they have no clue what's going on? There's no ownership. You want to transform a district? Invest in the individuals in the community. Invest in the members of the organization. Challenge them. Empower them to take ownership of the outcomes that we can provide for our children.
One of the challenges that schools have is to increase the learning gains of children in poverty. Reading, mathematics, the elementary level, middle school level, high school level. share your thoughts with us about what programs or what things you think can be implemented to improve those scores.
So my honest answer, we have teams from across the nation who come to Miami wanting to know what resources we use, what programs we use, how we are designed, what instructional technology are we using, what intervention programs do we use, what do we use for core instruction. And when they leave, I often feel as if they're asking the wrong questions. Those are all important. And I can run you through our content, our curriculum, and our resources. But those are tools that are used by teachers. The number one resource in a district are teachers. We need to be skilled in a way to empower them to use those resources, to use those tools to be best by kids. As a district, equally so, as we are in the midst of whatever my Florida standards are going to be, we're going to have to respond and react to those new standards. We need to ensure the folks, our content experts, are absolutely the best. They can evaluate the shifts and modifications in standards and identify these are the resources that are going to be best for Volusia students in order to continue to excel them to the next level. World-class districts are intentional in investing in the teachers and those who support teachers, maximizing our organizational design, maximizing our content, our curriculum.
We haven't talked too much about development of a strategic plan, so tell me your thoughts about that.
My thoughts are probably very significantly different than others. And once again, when people come in, they ask for our strategic plan. And we say it's radically different. And when they look at our radically different plan, the response typically is, oh, no, that's too much. We can't do that. But you're here because you want radically different results. As I said earlier, I believe a strategic plan can either pull you together or it can pull and silo an organization and tear them apart. We have one singular goal, student achievement. We use pillars that are pulled or woven together by our guiding principles. Guiding principles are the defined behaviors, rules of engagement on how we communicate, interact, believe, and connect to one another. How we are structured as an organization to be strong and tight as we implement the strategic plan. One singular goal, constantly defining the systems and structures of how we communicate and engage together. And then we look at pillars. The first pillar, as I said, same thing with a continuous improvement or school improvement process, culture. We ensure that we have a culture that grows all, every member of the organization. We start and we're intentional with culture. Then we ensure our strategic plan addresses world-class teachers, leaders, and staff. And I think I've spoken a lot about investing in world-class teachers, leaders, and staff. Once we have those two things in place, rigorous academic programs for all children. I don't care where you fall. From a level 5 to a level 1, I don't care your background, I don't care if you come from poverty, I don't care if you're a marginalized student, black or brown, we need to provide academic programs for them that accelerate their potential. Then we're going to have informed and engaged and empowered stakeholders. We just can't look internally at ourselves and our strategic plan. We need to push ourselves outside throughout the community and engage and inform them to help connect to us, partner with us, inform us to be a powerful transformational district. I just choked there. And then finally, sustainable business practices. As an organization, how are we designing business practices to build capacity and sustain outcomes and reducing cost over time?
This position
we're assuming you would start here, you would start in January, let's say. Quickly give me your thoughts about what you would be doing, hope to achieve in January, what you hope to achieve by April, and where you think you'd be by the end of June.
I have things I want to accomplish in December. This is a critical time of the school year. The days of easing into the holiday break are a thing of the past. This is a key time in our school year to evaluate our action over the first course of the year, to come together school by school to determine what has worked, what has been the growth of our students, where do we recalibrate, shift, or modify practice over the second part of the year in order to ensure an outcome. That needs to happen in December. I want the opportunity to sit with every principal, surrounded by cabinet, and problem solve. Talk me through your theory of action. Talk to me how you're supporting teachers. Talk to me about where you currently are at this point of the year. Talk to me about what you have learned regarding the ed implementation. And talk to me about the action that you're going to take in order to ensure a successful outcome. And then tell me, principal, what do you need from me? How can I help you? How can I uplift you in order to ensure you have everything you need from these members of cabinet in order to get this complex, difficult work done? I've already written about the external partners in our D schools. We should have zero Ds. We should have zero Cs. We should have zero Bs, which is a big statement. But trust me, it's a true statement. And we have to close the door on Schools of Hope. We have to close the doors on Hope operators. We have to close the door on external partners because it opens avenues for outside organizations and entities to come in who provide subpar support and subpar education. The core of this work is teaching and learning. We need to own it. We need to be the absolute best at it. And I know that we already are, so we can't pull ourselves away from doing that work. Those things need to happen in December. So where I am in third... That's just December, right?
I know.
So in the first 30 days, it's really connecting, moving through the organization, understanding the totality of the district, where we currently are, what is working, what isn't working, listening. Listening to the community, listening to district staff, listening to everybody in the organization, everyone in the county, while at the same time not just listening, describing what we can be as a district and the impact that we can have. Establishing a balance between where we currently are as a district and where we know we could be in order to strategically meet the needs of all students in our community. The next 30 days would be about establishing those guiding principles. If we're going to develop a strategic plan, we need to ensure that we know how to connect and interact and engage with one another, think with one another, learn from one another, so when we get to the point that we are implementing the plan, we're going to be successful. Strategic plans can be written, they can be great plans, but they're just words on paper. If we're going to be best by kids, we need to be intentional about how we function, connect, and work together. And then, in that last 30 days, it's the beginning process of engaging and connecting, reorganizing us as a district to think through how we shift and modify ourselves to be best by kids. And it's done collectively. It's done through a process, a protocol-driven process where we're facilitating conversations at multiple points of the organization to define opportunities to improve, refine, and modify practice to be best by kids.
Thank you. Board members, we do have some time. If any board member would like to ask an additional question, let me know. Seeing none? Do you have one? Ms. Cuthbert?
You definitely want to hold our principals accountable. If you uncover in your first 30 days, 90 days, a principal that you deem is not holding his or her weight up, what is your process of either retraining, keeping, reevaluating, or maybe dismissing that principal from his or her position.
So not knowing what that situation is.
Well, it could be anything.
Okay. Well, in some cases, it will be termination, and depending on what that may be. Standing operating procedure is setting expectation. Mm-hmm. Defining what the role is, what the expected outcome is going to be, and then moving forward, working together, upholding the support. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about a balance between support and accountability, the two don't work independently. If you're looking for a superintendent who says, this is your expected outcome, go and make it happen, I'm not your guy. But if you're looking for someone who says, this is the expected outcome, this is how we can be best by kids, and I am going to, A, hold you accountable to the outcome. And I'm going to do so because I know in my heart that I've done everything possible to invest in you as a person, to build your skill, to invest in you, to problem solve with you, to fail forward with you. It is a people-first business. So holding people accountable has never really been a difficult situation for me, because I know in my heart's heart, I'm constantly investing in them in order to ensure we're all finding success collectively.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cuthbert. Mr. Kalan.
And so I'm very big on the district being the source of news for our community. How do you envision or feel about being available to the media, newspaper, TV, et cetera?
An effective superintendent has the ability to leverage everything you just said. I think we need to be able to brand and market the great things that we're doing. We need to be intentional. We need to have a strategy. We need to have a plan. But we need to be at the forefront of drilling home a message to everyone in the community. These are the outstanding things that are happening in this community. We need to front load the message of the powerful practices that currently live here in Volusia County Schools, while at the same time having plans of action in place when something or a crisis happens. We're also at the forefront. We want our community to have trust and respect and ownership for us as a district. We can't do that by remaining silent.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Klein. Ms. Wright.
So in hearing all of that, one of the things for our district is succession planning. How do you, if you're the superintendent, how do you create and maintain the next generation of leaders in this district?
So as I said earlier, I am 100% invested in my own development. You will see that I will, on a national level, seek opportunities to grow myself, to ensure that I can continue to invest in Volusia County. Succession management is growing individuals within the organization who are ready to take the next step and lead at a higher level. We need to be growing superintendents. We need to be growing district or area superintendents. The success that Miami had really is all about the people in that organization, our intentional investment in them. Succession management is extremely important. It is the foundation of an organization. I believe in learning organizations, a lot of research out there on learning organizations, which fundamentally is the ability of an organization and the adults within that organization to continually refine and grow themselves.
Thank you, Ms. Wright. Any other questions for any board member? Seeing none, then we are to the point where we want you to have the opportunity to either ask the board any questions that you may have at this point, or also, if not, to give your closing comments and mention anything and that you think the board should know that we haven't already gleaned from this interview about before we make this important decision.
All right, so one important thing that I neglected to do and probably will get in trouble for not doing is acknowledge my wife who is back there with me.
So noted. All right, that's good. That's good. Yes,
yes, I married up. Yeah, no doubt about it. And really just thank her for being my partner in this work and giving up so much to invest in me. So take the time to acknowledge her. Just in terms of closing comments, about a year ago, my wife and I came here to help her brother and his wife move in to Port Orange. And as we drove up, well, actually, as we were driving up Port Orange, Orange County, I thought it was in Orlando. So we were about 45 minutes delayed, at which time my wife had a fruitful conversation with me about why can't men use ways to, you know, find out where they're going.
Said the same thing.
So we got there, we helped him move in, and spent the weekend exploring his new town. As we drove home, we spoke about how the town reminded us of what Homestead always wanted to be but never could be. I grew up in a small town, which is basically the gateway to the Keys, 40 miles outside of Miami. That's where I met that young lady over there. That is where we fell in love. That is where we got married. That is where we grew a family together and raised our children. So when this position came open, and it came open relatively quickly, it was extremely intriguing to have an opportunity to explore a place, possibly to be superintendent, that reminded us of home. Home is where your family is. Truth be told, the only family that I have in Miami is sitting right back there. Both of our families have moved away. Our daughters are in college. So that is intriguing. When this board took bold leadership and says we deserve and our students deserve, our community deserves a world-class educational system, that was intriguing. As I listened to the community, as you went through or continue to go through this process regarding what do we want in the next superintendent of Volusia County, I continued to be encouraged, not only in terms of what they were saying, but the alignment between what the board wanted in a superintendent and what the community wanted in a superintendent. I've had the privilege of working in one of the nation's most innovative districts. I have been pursued and pushed to apply for superintendent positions for about three and a half years. This is the first time, the first community that I thought this is a place where I can serve as superintendent. I'm not looking to be a superintendent or use Volusia to get a foot in the door and move up. My father was a principal of a school for 21 years. As I mentioned, I was a principal of three schools over 7 years. When he retired, his closing remarks to his faculty at his celebration was a validation to me as to what true leadership was. This is someone who invested in individuals for over 21 years, continued to grow them, continued to support them. It wasn't someone who went in and did something for 2 years and then went to another organization or another school or another district and did that same thing or repeated those same practices just at a different place. That's true leadership. That's the impact that I want to have here in Volusia County. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. You are aware, and your wife, I hope, is aware that we have this reception this afternoon. I promise there won't be any questions being asked. That part's over, at least for now.
Yeah, not by y'all, but there may be questions asked.
But there may be some questions from some other folks, but not from this group. I promise you that. It should be a fun time, relaxed time, and that starts at, 5:15, I guess, for them, right? Is it 4:45 now?
No. 5:15 for the meet and greet with the Citizens Advisory Committee, and then 6 o'clock for the reception.
Okay, 5:15 for the meet and greet with the Citizens Advisory Committee and 6 o'clock for the members of the general public. Dr. Moore, I want you to know that the school board will be meeting again in a regular session on November the 12th, that's Tuesday, at which time the board will make their final decision. So once again, thank you so much. Thank you for everything you've done throughout your career to dedicate yourself to helping children, to helping teachers, helping your community. You have a great deal of admiration from your community, from which they have sent many letters to us. I just have to make that point. So you should be proud of that. That concludes our meeting, and hope to see many of you at the reception this evening. We are adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.